Well, we're going to create some jobs, poisoning people. Got jobs, you hear me? Jobs.
They all say the tightening is filled. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Donna Cooper, senior fellow with the economic development team over at the Center for American Progress. We're going to be talking about these P3s, these public-private partnerships that the Corbett administration is trying to push through. And look, this has been the business solution to all of our societal problems. This has been both Democrats and Republicans. Bill Clinton brought it in as well. So we've seen a lot of politicians who think this is the silver bullet. This is how we're going to get our infrastructure up to date. This is how we're going to get education done. This is how we're going to do the military. By having these public-private partnerships where, you know, we can say that we're shifting the risk over to the private sector. Because, you know, they take on that kind of risks. Only at the end of the game, folks, it's still you and me who are holding the bag. And I think the mortgage crisis is a perfect example of that. And any right-winger out there who says, we need more public-private partnerships, think of your own rhetoric for a moment. Also, we're going to talk with Mitch Troutman, National Guest Worker Alliance, going to be here talking about their action against Hershey, what the workers are doing. Yesterday, they were in a church down in Lancaster. Today, here in Harrisburg, at one of the lawyer's offices, trying to hand this. And again, this lawyer just dumb. You would think a high-priced lawyer, a guy who makes $500,000 a year from the Hershey Trust, would have some idea of how to deal with crowds who want to hand him a petition. He should have just come down, taken the position, said, yes, thanks, and ended it. But no, they're going to stonewall, they're going to obstruct. So, of course, now a bigger story than it needed to be. But we'll talk to Mitch Troutman about that. Also in the second hour, Kate Gordon, Vice President of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress, also an advisor over at the Apollo Alliance, is going to talk to us from the National Clean Energy Summit 4.0, titled The Future of Energy, about where the nation goes from here, how we get off the foreign juice, how we power our economy, and how we make it a competitive market so that, you know what, we don't get screwed in the long run. I mean, you look at this oil gig, man. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? These oil companies have figured it out, man. Also in the second hour, Michael Evangelist will be here. He's the policy analyst for the National Employment Law Project. And you look at what's going on around the country with unemployment. Here, when the General Assembly comes back, we're going to have more attacks on unemployment compensation. He's going to talk a little bit about their study, what's going on in the different states, and how we ended up at this point, which, you know, they're talking about slashing benefits. Other states have slashed weeks. You look at Florida, for instance, as little as 12 weeks of unemployment is now the law down there. Now, understand, for 50 years, 26 weeks has been the standard. for some 50 years nationally. And what you're seeing is you're seeing all these states, because, you know, we need states to compete. Got to have the states to compete. They have the competition. They fight against each other. And they come up with 13 weeks, 12 weeks. I bid no weeks, no unemployment. And maybe that'll be the case at some point down the road. So it'll be an interesting talking to Mike about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So did everyone make it through the weekend and the storm okay? I know the power at my house was off for a couple of hours. Ended up picking up a bunch of tree branches, a whole bunch of wind damage around the house, not to the house, fortunately. I hope everyone did all right. The cleanup, they're saying, is going to cost in the neighborhood, the starting neighborhood, of $7 billion, thanks to Irene, somewhere between North Carolina and Maine. So you're looking at $7 billion right there, an awful lot of money. And what I find interesting, and maybe you saw this as well, but I find it interesting that now that it's over, and there was all this hype, and now that it's over, people are like, well, that wasn't so bad. That wasn't much. You look at the headlines of some of the newspapers, the L.A. Times, Irene, more sound than fury. The New York Times, some hurricane. New Yorkers grumble as danger passes. The Atlantic Wire, deconstructing the hurricane hype. And, you know, I was watching the news, the Weather Channel, over the weekend, because DirecTV actually had its own special channel that covered the hurricane. And 24/7 of all these bad newscasts from the area as the storm moved. And, you know, it's funny watching these folks, because they're clearly uncomfortable in an unscripted mode. Clearly. You know, these guys are live and up close. Most of it, I guess informational on some point, but redundant. But, you know, for people flipping through the channels, I guess redundancy is a good thing. Keep people up to date, keep the information flowing. But I just love the breathless breaking reports. You know, I just laughed. But none was better. And this is one of those viral videos where, you know, and here are a few headlines from the incident. Reporter gives update covered in sea foam. And I guess that's a nice way of saying he was dumped on, literally. The London Telegraph headline read, Hurricane Irene, reporter talks live, covered in raw sewage. More to the point, more honest. You got to love the UK reporting style over there. The Gothamist headline read, reporter gets slammed with raw sewage during Hurricane Irene. And Huffington Post, Tucker Barnes is probably the remnants of raw sewage. And I look at this and I go, you look at the thing and it was just nasty. And the guy's out there for like 5.5 minutes. And the people who are in the studio, I think they did it on purpose. They kept going back to him so he'd have to stand out there longer while they're telling him, you should be going inside. But I got one more question. What's that like? And it's hysterical. And the station, of course, it was a Fox affiliate. They later confirmed that they believed that the foam was probably a combination of raw sewage, gray-green algae, and oils from decomposing animals. So, yeah, that's something I think I want to be completely covered in, top to bottom, front to back, knee deep, in his mouth, in his eyes. Yeah, raw sewage, beautiful, beautiful stuff. But, you know, everyone's talking about the hype. You know, the Daily Beast, they had their headline story, 9 Biggest Overreactions. And, you know, they went through a couple of the governors, like Christie telling people to get off the beach and get into the house. But you click on the Daily Beast's main page. And, you know, you can say it's overreaction. You could say, you know, that's, you know, it was a big hype. But you click on the main story and it reads, Irene tolls rise, at least 33 dead in 10 states. And I don't know that that's hype. You know, you look at the reality in this, and according to the this guy, Peter Marici, an economist at the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business, the damage from this and the loss of economic activity could cost us about $45 billion. Now, they're talking $7 billion just for the cleanup. That's the start. That's the starting rate, probably going to go much higher than that. And you look at the Republicans who are doing a masterful job, got to give them credit. They're holding the line. Because what's happening now is FEMA doesn't have the money. They've got to take it from other disasters. They've got to take it from the folks in Joplin. They've got to take it from places around the country because they don't have it. So what's going to happen is Obama's going to have to go and ask for some supplemental funding. It's got to happen. He's got to go to Congress and say, look, we need some disaster relief money, and we need it soon. So here's where you're going to start seeing this fight. And, you know, so get ready. The Republicans are going to do this. Any fight for additional funds for FEMA? massive rumble. Because they don't really believe in government. They have this, sorry, Charlie, you're on your own mentality. You look at Ron Paul, who's come out and said, well, we need spending cuts in order for us to address the hurricane relief. Because that's his belief. And we talked about this Friday. He doesn't believe in FEMA at all, shouldn't exist, shouldn't do anything. You should be on your own. Local areas should have to take care of themselves. And I guess, you know, that's part of their vision of the country. 50 individual states, 50 individual sets of problems, and then we fight each other over that. In fact, Rick Perry this weekend said that, you know, I like the fights. I like the states competing against one another. Yeah, let's beat the hell out of each other before we get into the global economy. Yes, that's the leader I want running the country. And Cantor, Eric Cantor, House Majority Leader, he confirmed that, you know what, no money. You're going to have to start cutting stuff. You're going to have to slash and burn and all of that. And I find it ironic that they take that position today, the sixth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which cost this nation dearly. You look at the money that we put out for this, and it's a lot. And the president issued a release. The statement he released earlier said what required us is our continued effort to make sure that New Orleans and the Gulf fully recover and to make sure that our response to such disaster is the best it can possibly be. I don't think anybody can point to this president and say he didn't do everything he could possibly do to meet the needs of the people so far in this hurricane. I don't think anybody can point to him and say he did like Bush did. No, not going to happen. Obama then pointed to the federal government's effort to enhance their preparedness. You want to enhance the preparedness efforts so that Americans are ready before disasters strike and to strengthen our recovery capabilities so that we are more resilient after disaster strikes. And I got to give him credit because you'll remember Bush was what did he do? Was he eating cake, playing guitar on a tarmac somewhere? If I remember that right, you know, he was with John McCain strumming or something. And you look at Katrina, the costliest natural disaster in the country's history. Property damage alone somewhere in the $81 billion range. And they're saying one of the top five deadliest hurricanes, taking the lives of some more than 1,800 people. And I started thinking back today, how did we respond to Katrina? It's been 6 years, and they're still not back to where they should be. But how did we respond? Well, we responded by gutting labor laws, eliminate the minimum wage, eliminate prevailing wage laws, remember, fire all the teachers and privatize the education. And I started thinking, you know, disaster is really a right-wing boon. I mean, they really get their policies pushed through, and they don't waste any time when there's a disaster. And they really don't waste any time filling the pockets of those who need it least. And we saw that during Katrina with all the no-bid contracts and all the cronyism that went on. And the trash story still sticks in my head. They spent $2 billion on trash removal at the end. And I remember it. It was like 47 bucks a cubic ton or something like I forget what the metrics were. But it was like 47 bucks. And the guy who actually moved it, they paid 47. The guy who actually moved it made like $3. So all along that subcontractor, everyone, someone took their bite. And it's much like the scenario going on over at Hershey, where Hershey, you know, owns the building. They subcontracted it out to XL. XL said, well, we don't want to hire people. We'll subcontract that out to this guy. And the guy who hires people said, well, we don't really want to hire them. We'll just supply you with them because we'll take them from somebody else. And that's how you ended up with the scenario you have. And everybody pointing fingers at everybody else. At the end, another example of the failure of our labor laws. Going to take a quick break right back after this with Donna Cooper, senior fellow of the economics policy team there at the Center for American Progress, right back after this. Get up.
Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Most Americans agree that the first order of business for the Congress and the President when they get back from summer vacation should be jobs. On Friday, the Center for American Progress released a report called Spurring Job Creation in the Private Sector, three elements that any jobs plan should have. The report is intended to give President Barack Obama direction as he tries to convince the GOP to stop obstructing his proposals. The three core recommendations from the proposal are investing in the nation's infrastructure by creating a new infrastructure bank, addressing the foreclosure crisis head-on, and assisting homes and businesses become more energy efficient. Donna Cooper explained that investing in infrastructure is spending domestically because it results in concrete, steel, and asphalt demand. She added that the previous stimulus shows that construction jobs benefit from infrastructure investments.
There is plenty of work and plenty of pent-up demand that once federal action is taken, states and localities can begin to pull the plans off the shelves and let the contracts, as they demonstrated they could do during the first stimulus package, and significantly improve their local economies.
California farm workers are on the march. Doug Cunningham reports.
Farm workers have begun a 200-mile march to California's state capital in Sacramento, pushing for enactment of the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. The 13-day march is an effort to win the right for farm workers to be paid overtime after 8 hours a day and 40 hours in a week like any other worker. Despite the support that labor unions give to Democratic politicians, California's Democratic Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act 2 months ago. Farm workers rallied at California's Capitol and some participated in hunger strikes in a vain effort to convince Brown to sign the legislation. If enacted, this legislation would also help protect farm workers from often brutal conditions in the fields, and it would make it easier for farm workers to join unions through a majority sign-up provision. 50 full-time marchers will be joined by other farm workers and their supporters throughout the 200-mile march route to Sacramento. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Well, you know, it seems that everything else is for sale. Why not our infrastructure? Why not our roads and bridges and our state wine and spirit shops? Yeah, put it all up on the auction block. Let's see what we can get. You'll remember back in April, our governor signed an executive order creating a transportation committee. Their charge was creating a comprehensive strategic blueprint for how we pay for years of underinvestment in our roads, bridges, and mass transit system. Now, the committee predictably decided that public-private partnerships were the answer. And while Pennsylvania for years has underinvested in its infrastructure, I would argue so has the nation, as we continue to hear the same bad ideas coming out of Washington and Harrisburg, you gotta examine this stuff. These P3s, more privatization, all I keep hearing is more tax cuts. I think it's a failed policy, but here to help me work through this P3 dance is Donna Cooper. Donna is a senior fellow with the economic policy team at the Center for American Progress, not to mention someone pretty well known here in the Harrisburg area for her years of service with the Rendell administration. Donna, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Great to talk with you.
You know, I look at this report, and it says Pennsylvania's in trouble, and P3s seem to be all the rage. Let me ask you, as someone who has worked on the public side, are P3s the silver bullet solution to Pennsylvania's problem?
Well, no. You know, I kind of feel like it's the scene in Carousel where the snake oil salesman came to town. And, we have a problem in America because we actually want infrastructure for free. And we think, boy, if we could get some private company to build our highway, it would be for free. But Those of us who have been driving the Pennsylvania Turnpike for the last 5 years, we know that our tolls have been rising. And most certainly with the privatization of roads, or as you point out, state stores, we're going to pay a higher price. Now, we're going to pay it one way or another. Infrastructure isn't free. But when we pay it after it's been privatized, we're not just covering the cost of the infrastructure. We're covering somebody's profit margin.
Absolutely.
So if everybody is against tax increases, which it sounds like, you know, that's sort of the word of the day, then we're going to be paying for profit margins. One way or another, we're paying.
And that's the discussion that people have to have, because I think you've pointed it out accurately. It's been thrown out to us that this is the silver bullet. The risk to you and me, the taxpayer, or to the taxpayers of the state of Pennsylvania, going to be severely limited. We won't be responsible for it. But I got to be honest, I don't see that being the case. I think at the end of the day, regardless, the taxpayer is still on the hook for this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And remember, when we were trying to privatize the Pennsylvania Turnpike and use some of that money to repair I-80, it would have required higher tolls on the turnpike, and it would have required tolls on I-80. Now, that was the going proposal because nobody was willing to think about a gas tax increase. So if you can't do a broad-based tax increase and you need to repair your roads, then you have to come up with ways to spend other people's money up front and pay it back over time. But, you know, if you pay for a road over time, which kind of makes sense because it's a long-term asset, it costs more. And certainly if a private company's coming in, you know, good old American way, they're going to want profit. You know, we don't think there's anything wrong with that, except for that I'm not sure you and I should be paying for it.
No, absolutely.
I think a much better way to go about this is to increase fuel taxes, vehicle mile taxes, carbon taxes, and then pay for our roads through the state capital budget like, you know, we ought to be doing.
Absolutely. You know, and I got to be honest, full disclosure, I was completely against the idea, and it was the during the Rendell years, of privatizing the turnpike. If the tolls were going to go up, why didn't we just raise the tolls and it go back into the coffers? That's an asset that I'm a stakeholder in, or a shareholder, whatever you want to say. That's part of the state assets, part of my assets.
Right, but the reason we couldn't do it the way you said is because if we had privatized it, we would have gotten $16 billion, and we could have used that to improve the roads in other parts of the state. So the challenge is that the Pennsylvania legislature, you know, which now has its second transportation committee, basically this transportation committee that Governor Corbett and the legislature put together didn't just say do P3s. They also said we need to spend more state money. And that's exactly what the last Transportation Commission said, and that's what every Transportation Commission is going to say, because at, you know, at a relatively low gas tax rate compared to anybody else in the world, we've got to rebuild our infrastructure. It means that all of us who are driving, trucks and cars, are going to have to pay a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think if you lay it out in a constructive way and say, look, this is the stuff we use, I think most people are going to be adults and say, all right, well, if we have to, we have to. But these schemes that keep popping up where, oh, this is going to be the magic fix, and it doesn't seem to work.
Well, you know what's interesting, Rick, is there was a poll done. Actually, Governor Rendell, when he was starting Building America's Future, did a poll, and they found that most Americans think that their gas taxes increased every year. Like, they don't know that the gas tax at the state level hasn't been increased, I don't know, in about 8 years or 9 years. I can't remember the last time that was increased, certainly before the Rendell administration came in. And the federal gas tax hasn't been increased since the 90s. So we have had a flat, you know, revenue source with growing demand.
Right.
So, you know, I can't say that I want to really blame particularly Democrats who are trying to put forward an agenda to build infrastructure. I can't blame them for saying public-private partnerships are a way to go because it generates a lot of upfront money, and that's what we need, and that's what's going to put people to work. But as you say, if we were mature adults and we were willing to just pay the gas tax, like everybody else in the world and a developed country has to do, that's what generates jobs, and that's what gives us good roads, bridges, transit systems. And Rick, you know, bridges in PA, that's a big deal.
Oh, absolutely. But my problem with this idea of upfront money is I see that, you know, I see that as another opportunity for speculation. I see that as another bubble almost that you and I, the taxpayers, end up getting stuck with. And I, you know, I look at Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, who was talking about the bank bailouts, and he said, quote, new forms of public private the bank the easy for me to say, right? The bank bailout is a new form of public-private partnership, one in which public shareholders shoulder all the risks and the private sector gets all the profits. So, you know, again, I look at this as another opportunity for the smart people who have a lot of money to speculate, to blow this bubble up, and at the end of the day, I'm left holding the bag.
You're right. Now, you could take it from an even more progressive bent, which would be to say, look, let's spend their money up front and divide the profits over time. I mean, there is probably a way to structure this where the public benefits much more than the kinds of proposals that have been put on the table.
Yeah, but we both know that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
you and I never win in this.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah. I don't think, it doesn't matter what state, I don't think the taxpayers, Joe Average Six Pack, he doesn't benefit in this. The Wall Street speculators, the smart, look, a rich guy is not going to put money into a project he's not going to make a boatload back on.
Well, and actually, to your point, even if we were able to structure a deal where there was a win-win for the taxpayers and Wall Street has enough lobbyists to take away the winnings of you and I.
Exactly.
So, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to end up with significantly more resources than the average taxpayer is going to benefit. In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us. And you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80. You got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere. So, you know, that was a pretty stunning statement. They were pretty bold about that. They're like, we're not scared of infrastructure. We just need our profits.
Absolutely. And I understand
that. You know, I'm not sure public infrastructure is supposed to profit anybody.
I'm not sure healthcare is supposed to profit anybody either. But look at all the profit money that goes upward out of that. I mean, again, you know, I look at this and I just see these public-private partnerships as another place rife with abuse.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that happens, you know, not just does Joe Sixpack maybe lose out in this deal, but by and large, in my experience in Pennsylvania, and as you say, this is not a statement about Pennsylvania, the average House member and the average senator, and in fact, most of the governor's staff and the agency staff, they aren't financial wizards. That's not where they come from. They're average citizens, they're engineers, they're insurance salesmen, they're realtors, and now they're in a world of high finance, sitting across the table from a guy from Morgan Stanley or, you know, J.P. Morgan or Chase or somebody selling them on a deal.
Yep.
And those guys know how to wrap that deal up with a ribbon and make it sound like a great Christmas present for you.
Yeah, I mean, someone who won a popularity contest and a slick Wall Street lawyer, there's no competition there.
Exactly. And not only that, that's like what Wall Street lawyer has deep pockets. And he can walk his way around the building, buy a few lunches and dinners. In Pennsylvania, our campaign finance laws are, you know, among the worst in the country. And so, you know, it's not hard to buy a P3. Now, I will say that there's a lot of, you know, good people in Pennsylvania, too, who are questioning this, like you, like other people in the union movement, but people in the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, because, you know, they know in the long term, instead of paying a private equity firm an extra $10 billion for a transportation deal, I could put that $10 billion into roads and bridges. So, you know, there is a cost benefit for the public that I think we need to be much more astute and schooled about so we ask the right questions.
Right. So what are the right questions? I mean, because, you know, I want the infrastructure improved. I think the majority of people, they're not going to be willing to have massive tax hikes for infrastructure. I think there's a stomach for maybe a little bit, but I don't know, massive tax hikes. So what would you suggest?
Well, I think the first question is, I guess the question I would ask myself is, am I willing to pay a dime more for a gallon of gas to repair all of Pennsylvania's roads and bridges? Because that's the scale we're talking about. We're not talking about doubling the price of gas per gallon. We're not doubling the rate of tax per gallon. We're saying in the case of the Pennsylvania, you have more than enough money if you rose the price by 10 cents. So can you spare a dime? Brother, can you spare a dime? It seems to me that's a much better strategy to take than to begin to structure complicated P3s where over time money's leaving the state of Pennsylvania that could otherwise be used to repair our roads.
Yeah, I'm not
that
against,
would be the first question I would ask.
Yeah, I'm not against the idea of raising the gas tax, but here's my problem. There are some folks who can't afford it. I mean, we've got people who are making minimum wage, and I don't know how they make it now. I don't know how they pay another extra 10 cents. Would there be a way maybe of somehow rebating that or helping folks who are at the bottom of the economic scale who need the help?
Well, you know, you raise another good question. Just because I'm from PA, I happen to know that, you know, we could impose an unearned income tax in Pennsylvania. People who make money not from earnings but from investments in Pennsylvania have, you know, no state tax on those earnings. We only have an income tax on earned income. And so you could decide that you would offset the burden of a gas tax increase on a family making $30,000 or $40,000 a year by putting a minuscule tax on unearned income in Pennsylvania, and thereby, you know, having the people who are have the greatest largesse in our economy contribute a little bit more, so that everybody has access to safe, high quality, and uncongested public goods. Right?
Yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah, come on, you got to remain optimistic.
Look, I'm on board with you. I guess I'm just too realistic. The reality is, given the Republican-led legislature here, I got a better chance of passing the Employee Free Choice Act here in Pennsylvania than I've got passing another tax on wealthy people. Oh, heaven forbid!
The crazy thing is, though, it's so archaic in Pennsylvania because our tax is 3.07 cents. 3.07% on all income. So there's just so many people of means who could be making a greater contribution to our state economy and certainly to our public assets. And if they live in almost in any other state, they'd be paying more. You know, so even if you were only to ratchet that up like a tenth of a percent, the amount of income generated by that would be so significant that it could offset the cost of a gas tax increase for families who are struggling.
Yeah, but
I mean, look, another question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, do we think it's a good idea to go over unsafe bridges? Another question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we want to leave the infrastructure to our children? We got it in pretty good shape because our parents and Eisenhower, you know, they spent a lot of money. They invested. When my dad was just getting into the workforce and Eisenhower was building the highways, the high tax rate was 70%. And in the first term of Reagan, it got lower to 50%. And today, it's significantly lower. So, you know.
Actually, it was worse than that. During the Eisenhower years, 1953.
No, it was in the 90s. Absolutely, it was in the 90s.
It was 92%.
Yeah, it was in the 90s. So, you know, people of means were paying much more to keep this country going, and they still had significant disposable income to live on. No one was crying over the poverty that they had to suffer through after they paid their taxes. And we had a booming economy, and we're building the world's best infrastructure. And today we have the lowest tax rates on the wealthy that I was looking at that this morning, perhaps like 100 years.
Actually, 60 years, the lowest tax.
60 years.
60 years.
So the lowest tax rate in 60 years, and we have a struggling economy and a crumbling infrastructure, and we're losing our competitive edge economically, globally. And it seems to me those things have to be connected. And, you know, it would be untenable to suggest that we should go back to a 92% tax rate. But should we go to a 36, 40? Perhaps that would generate a significant amount of money to help improve our infrastructure. Think of this, Rick. Just the Bush tax cuts on the top 2% earners cost us $100 billion a year.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm on
board
with that.
Two times the rate of what we spend annually at the federal level for roads and bridges.
Yeah, I think the people who are benefiting from our infrastructure, benefiting from all the things that my grandparents and parents' generation invested in, they should be helping to kick in a little bit. I'm right there with you.
Yeah, and so the challenge is that how do we think about this in a way that people who have limited means become educated enough to make that kind of demand? Because one of the things about the Pennsylvania legislature, and your show is a great service to this, is that it is very insular. It's way up there in Harrisburg. It's far from the major population centers in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Scranton and Allentown. And Lancaster's pretty far from all those places, although Lancaster's, you know, close. But people you know, the legislature is able to operate in far too much anonymity and far too much isolation. And the degree to which listeners of this show are reaching out to other people they know in the state and saying, you know what, we all have to be part of this infrastructure conversation because I'm sick of driving over unsafe bridges and congested and broken roads and over train tracks and train bridges that, you know, if you looked at them, you would be astonished that you were willing to go on a train to go over them. And we need to have a common solution to this, and it is going to require revenues.
Yep.
Especially in a state like Pennsylvania with the lowest personal income tax rate in the country.
I would raise my taxes enough not to have to replace my shocks every year.
Yeah, right. In fact, you raise a good point. People spend more on car repairs in Pennsylvania than the price of a 1% increase in their personal income tax for moderate income earners.
See, I mean, there's so much thought that should go into this, but all I kept hearing, P3s, that's it, P3s. Brilliant.
Well, here's what's driving that. You have to. The other part about this is that there is significant traffic on the 202 corridor outside of Philadelphia. And their view in southeast Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is if we toll that road, we can improve it and widen it, and it wouldn't be a burden to the state. And the only way we can really toll it is we need to create an authority, get a private bank in there to finance the improvements, and then pay them back over time in the tolls. And so the southeastern delegation is very, very motivated by this. Now, they may have a unique circumstance, and maybe people in the southeast would be willing to pay a profit to the privatizing forces to do that road, but the rest of the state would be no better off. And there really isn't anything else in the state that has that velocity of traffic other than the turnpike that could be privatized. So if anybody thinks it's a solution to transportation infrastructure in Pennsylvania, they're fooling themselves. It's a 202 solution, could be a turnpike solution, but it's a solution at high cost for both of those to the drivers, and it will have no impact on any other part of the transportation infrastructure in the state.
And like all of the P3s, they're going to probably get nice low rate loans, virtually no interest, and they'll be able to charge us back and make a tidy sum for themselves, and that's the plan. Donna Cooper, I appreciate the time, senior fellow with the economic policy team over at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Look forward to talking to you again. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts? Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
If Rick Snyder ever comes to help you, run away as fast and as far as you can. Snyder is the right-wing corporate-hugging governor of Michigan, whose extremist anti-worker, anti-government agenda was handed to him by a Koch-funded front group named the Mackinac Center. Included in the package was a doozy of autocratic mischief-making called the Local Government Fiscal Accountability Act. The new law turned Snyder into a perverse hybrid of a Soviet czar and a ten-horned banana republic potentate, and it has infuriated the public. Now trying to backpedal, the governor's new line is that it's about helping communities. Helping? This law allows him to seize control of any city, county, school district, etc., that he decides is in fiscal trouble, authorizing him to appoint an emergency manager, which may be a private corporation, to run the entity. This autocratic region is empowered to cancel labor contracts, repeal the public budget, privatize government assets, dismiss elected officials, and even dissolve the local entity. This is the kind of help that a fox brings to the hen house. So the governor is now being sued by his own astonished citizenry. Snyder's tyrannical law, they point out, violates the state's constitution by usurping the right of local residents to elect their officials. As the director of a community legal group in Detroit puts it, the governor's designated emergency manager would control all, including the right to enact or repeal local ordinances. This is Jim Hightower saying, you might be thinking, thank goodness I don't live in Michigan. But if Snyder's anti-democratic coup succeeds there, You can bet that various Koch-backed right-wing front groups will bring the Michigan model to your state. For information on the Michigan fight, contact Detroit's Sugar Law Center at www.sugarlaw.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go there and download our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, just download the Stitcher app and take the program on the go with you. I got to tell you, I was not expecting that interview to go the way it went with Donna Cooper. Being a member of the Rendell administration, I was expecting some middle of the road. I was not expecting her to say Wall Street told us to go to hell and tax the rich. Wasn't expecting that. That was a nice turn of events there. I'm still kind of shocked. Still a little in shock over that. Also, House Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy, he is the third ranking member of the Republican House of Representatives. He went after Mitt Romney, just asking the question why during a presidential run he would choose to quadruple the size of his family's beach house. McCarthy said he needs to stop staying in hotels and start staying with volunteers at every campaign stop. His job should be to take out the trash every day, and if that bag breaks, he needs to clean it up. That's something that Michelle Bachmann's taken a bit over in Iowa. They're calling her the rock star, I guess. So interesting stuff. So today, we saw the J1 workers from Hershey. They were here in Harrisburg taking a petition over to Leroy Zimmerman's office, a guy who made over $500,000 in 2010 from the Hershey Trust. On Sunday, they attended a service at the Lancaster Faith Tabernacle Church of God in Christ as they pushed through with their kitchen table tour of central Pennsylvania. And I've got Mitch Troutman on the line, field organizer for the National Guest Workers Alliance. Mitch, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, how you doing?
Can you tell me what this kitchen table tour is?
The kitchen table tour is the J1 students at Hershey's. Delegations of them will be going across Pennsylvania, and have been, to meet with local working and unemployed people and really be able to connect with the people of the state.
So I think most people who listen to this program know exactly what's going on, because we've been covering it from the beginning. We were there when the kids came out of the building on strike and walked the picket line. I think so. Folks have the idea here. It's the follow up. I know you guys have been doing a lot in the communities, and this is another example. Tomorrow, I understand you'll be up in the Wilkes-Barre area.
Yeah, we'll be going up to Wilkes-Barre tomorrow. We'll be doing a tour of the economic history of the area. Then we'll be having a rally in, what's the square they're called? The square, public square. And then after that, we'll actually get to meet with some people who are part of the Piston Mine Strike.
Wow, that sounds interesting. Because one of the things I've noticed in talking, like today they were here in Harrisburg to deliver a petition to Leroy Zimmerman, one of the people on the Hershey Trust board. And when I talk to people on the street, they are just taken by what these kids have been able to accomplish in such a very short period of time. And I think you guys are doing a good job as well pushing this forward.
Yeah, thank you very much. The support from just regular people on the street, wherever, has been, it's been amazing. And it's been overwhelming, honestly. I'm trying to set up stops for the kitchen table tour. We've had so many offers that it's been hard to choose. So I appreciate it. I'm sure some of your listeners are some of those people. So thank you very much.
I mean, I look at these kids, and I talked to a couple of them today again. Absolutely just amazing. Because, as I was telling one person on the street today, what they're doing, what those kids are doing in this country, in their home countries, may get them in a situation where they're never seen again.
I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. There are a lot of threats coming from the sponsors inside the home countries, but we think they're mostly just threats. Of course, there is different dangers associated with doing this in other countries, like like China. But the students, as they stand, will be safe when they go home.
No, I mean they'll be safe when they go home. What I'm saying is, if they were to do this in their home country, if they were to stand up and go out on strike, there's a pretty good chance that, well, who knows?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the students come from a lot of different places. The students in China, of course, China's very, very strict about those things. And of course, violent sometimes. But the students in Turkey, a lot of them come out of student organizing in their campuses too.
All right. Well, maybe I didn't get to speak to some of those. The kids I talked to, because I specifically asked the question, is where we went on this. So, what's the game plan from this point forward? The kids came out of the warehouse. They're on strike. They delivered petitions. They're doing this tour. What's the end game here?
Well, the students have split into the inside group and the outside group. The inside group stays inside the factory and acts as labor justice monitors and report on the conditions, while the outside group does the kitchen table tour as well as other actions and meeting with people. And we'll be escalating, and we'll have some bigger announcements soon. But it's our hope that we don't need to do any of this and that Hershey will come to the table, which is why we went down to Zimmerman today. He wouldn't accept the petition, but we faxed it to his office, and it was a good 6 or 7 inches thick worth of paper. So
yeah, I saw.
I hope to hear from him.
Well, you know, and I looked at that, and I got to be honest, I thought it was a dumb thing that he didn't come down or send someone down to accept the petition and just defuse the situation right there, or allow one person to go up and deliver it and then just chuck it in the trash. It seems to me that every step of the way, Hershey and Excel and now Mr. Zimmerman, they've done everything they can possibly do to inflame this situation.
Yeah, they should really recognize that. They can't ignore us and we'll go away. We're not going away. The students are strong. And, their stock has been dropping. Their image has been hurt. And it would really be a lot better for everybody if they just gave in to the simple demands.
And what are the simple demands?
That the workers get paid back the money that they paid to come here. And that the jobs be given to local workers and be made living wage jobs for them.
Yeah, and this is an opportunity where I think the unions in the area have an opportunity to say, look, if you want to make sure that these are good family-sustaining jobs, you should allow the workers to organize and make sure of that so that we never have these problems again.
Yeah, momentum like this coming from the student strike, it doesn't come too often, so people should be jumping on it every way they can.
So what can we do to help?
Well, there is a strike fund on the website of the National Guest Workers Alliance, which is guestworkeralliance.org. But, of course, money isn't the only way to help. We'll have various actions and things that we'll be announcing in a few days. We'll be announcing some things. Right now, we've got to work on our asks, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, because at the end of this, there's got to be an end game because you've got the public sympathy. The people I talk to on the street most certainly are with you. And then the end question was always, well, how do you make it right? And the way I laid it out is, look, you got to make these kids whole because they were most certainly cheated in all of this. And at the end of this, those jobs can't just go to another exploitable class of people. It's got to be something that we make sure are filled by folks who are going to be there.
Sorry about that. Hershey's really needs to recognize that. I mean, the students are very aware. They're student workers, and they don't want this going to guest workers who are exploited. They don't want this going to temp workers who are exploited. They don't want it going to any sort of scheme that they can come up with, and it's not that difficult, Hershey has the money. Work is worth the money.
My wife, when years and years ago, when she was in college, went to Spain and to Germany for a cultural exchange program. And the way she talked about it, it was a life-changing event. It was, it was everything that she imagined it would be. And I asked her how ticked off she would be if she was sent there to work in a warehouse or a factory. And she'd have been pretty ticked off. So I look at this, the opportunity of these kids to come to this country and experience the country and having that taken away from, I think it would tick me off an awful lot.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too, that Hershey's has been doing this for 10 years. And these students have various different backgrounds, but they're going to be professionals in their home countries. And so you have 10 years' worth of professionals across the world who have had this experience. You know, what does that do for American image that we've treated so many people this way?
You know, I'll tell you the last thing before we wrap up. What I'm hoping that people take from this is the courage of conviction and the strength that these student workers have shown, and I hope American workers look at them and go, we should do that.
Yeah, the students are strong, and it is not easy. We've heard again and again, wow, you know, I don't know if my friends and family and everything would do this, but everyone can. There's nothing, they're amazing, but there's nothing special about them in that way where there's something preventing anybody else from taking the same level of action.
I agree. Mitch Troutman, I appreciate your time. Let us know if anything else is going on and if we can help.
Great. Thank you very much. Yeah,
thanks so much. Mitch Troutman, field organizer for the National Guest Workers Alliance. We got their website linked at ours at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mitch's name. It'll take you right there. And, you know, I look at this, Jake, and the reality is these kids, you know, they're amazing. And, you know, I don't know that Mitch wanted to go there, but the folks that I talk to in their home countries, you know, doing this kind of stuff would get you in some trouble.
Oh, I believe, especially the kids from China. You got to admire these kids. They were very intelligent, and some of them, I don't know if you picked up on this, Rick, some of them had a very good command of the English language.
Well, that is why they came here.
I realize that. And isn't it ironic that they themselves, quicker than a lot of Americans in this area who have seen what has happened, have said, look, these jobs should be going to Americans. And yet, when you talk to Americans, you know, they come, some of them are accusing these kids of being opportunists, and if they don't like it here, they should go home. You should praise these kids. Not only should you praise these kids, you should admire them and hope that your children turned out as good as these kids. And here's another thing. Is this the impression of the ugly American? Is this the impression we want to leave with these kids? And I would suggest, and I think you kind of touched on it, Rick, that some of these kids could turn out to be pretty influential when they're in their home countries. They're very intelligent. Some of them have a little bit of connections. And, you know, 20 years, 30 years from now down the road, who knows? And who knows what this experience will do? It can be a real positive towards America. On the other hand, it can be a real negative.
So today they were down here in Harrisburg at the at Leroy Zimmerman's office. He's one of the guys on the.
He's the chairman.
He's the chairman.
He's the chairman
of
the board.
one of their boards, right?
Mm-hmm.
The entertainment and resort part of it made over $500,000. Another guy, James Neville, well over $500,000. You look at the money that's going to this board. And you go, really? All of this money to feed these boards when the average nonprofit foundation is paying about $25,000 for their board member. The average for-profit, paying somewhere in the range of $120,000.
You know, that doesn't make sense. You would think Hershey and all its related boards would do everything they could, especially publicly,
to be above reproach.
To be above reproach, smooth this over, come across as a good corporate citizen. And when these kids really reach out to the corporation and you publicly turn your back on them, that's not good PR.
Well, I mean, Hershey, all of them all along the way have done the worst possible job. And that's good for the kids. It's good for the NGA. It's good for the people who oppose Hershey, because you want people making blunders like this. I look at this protest this afternoon. They went down simply to deliver a petition with 63,000 signatures on it. They got 63,000 people to sign on to this petition. They went into the building. The security guard stopped them. The people up in the upper floors said, no, we don't want to talk to you. We're not going to let you up. We're not going to send anyone down. Now you've caused a scene. Now the kids, you know, started chanting and carrying on. The police were called. I think they called every cop car on the beat, all four of them, and the parking enforcement car. They were there too, I guess, to make sure that, you know, no one illegally parked. But, you know, did you need to do that? And at the end of it would have been very simple for one person to come down and say, you know what? I'll take your petition and I'll make sure that it gets into the right hands. You would have defused the situation. It would have been over and that would have been it. Now instead they, and you know, I'm glad they did. I'm glad they fought this because, you know, this gives those kids more resilience and it gives them more of a mission to go after them to make them hear their side. But, well, I'll tell you, you know, at the end of this, they could possibly do wrong, they've been doing.
First, you can say Excel was running the what we call the EDC, Eastern Distribution Center. And on the day of the protest, they can say, well, that was, you know, that wasn't us. But, in fact, that there's no question that Hershey was behind that massive, massive police response. I mean, in some ways, I had to sit back and laugh.
Look, when they went up to talk to the people at the building, the people in the building handed them the number to the Hershey PR department. They handed them the card with the guy from Hershey to deal with the situation. So if Excel is saying, here, these are the people to talk to, those are the people to talk to. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. That product is still the product of Hershey. It's still theirs. I don't care what you say about it. Your reputation is based on who you use and how it gets to market. If you're using exploitable labor, if you're using these kids the way they've been for the last 10 years, and then before that, I understand they were abusing a couple other programs. If you've got a history of doing this, this reflects back on Hershey.
Well, I think there ought to be a probe, in-depth probe, and I believe that's happening. It would be interesting to see where all this money is going.
Well, I mean, where the probe has to be is in our labor laws as a whole. This idea that we can subcontract, have independent contractors, bring in J-1 visa people, you know, have all of these different classifications, leads one to believe that our labor laws are broken. This idea that we can hire independent contractors who are going to be able to get away with not paying unemployment, not paying workers' comp, not paying a lot of the things that we've decided as a society are important for having employees, if we're allowing some to skate away from doing that, then that's a real problem for the people who are paying it. You're setting up a scenario, a race to the bottom scenario, where now you've got people competing who don't have the same costs. Now you're on two different planes. And that person who's not paying their fair share is pulling everybody else down. And that's part of the equation that's not being talked about. And one of the things I was hoping Mitch would be able to tell us is what the end game on this is. Because to me, the end game is just not about getting the kids their money back. That's part of it. But the end game is about making those jobs good-paying local jobs that sustain families. And looking at the program that they came to this country under and saying, how can we meet the mission of the program, which is to have those kids have a cultural experience of this country so that they can go home? Because as you pointed out, they're going to be tomorrow's leaders in that country to have a goodwill program. My wife, who went to Toledo, Spain, and went to Germany, she has wonderful memories of those people, of those experiences, and that's the kind of cross-border discussions we need to have. Those are the relationships that we need to have as nations. The problem in this country is too few of us do those kind of things, so we don't know what to expect. And you have some moron who's, well, they should have known. They read the small print of the contract. They knew what they was getting into. No, they don't.
I've heard that.
And at the end of it, it comes down to how do we treat people?
My experience when I was younger, there used to be cultural exchanges and groups used to be their sponsors. And they would come and they would have they wouldn't be working. We would get familiarity with our culture. And that somehow has gone away. I think at the very least, either eliminate the work part of it or very much minimize the amount of hours that they can be worked.
Yep, I'm right there. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Kate Gordon, Vice President of Energy Policy at American Progress. She's at the big National Clean Energy Summit 4.0, the future of energy in Las Vegas. I'm going to talk about the future of energy right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Most Americans agree that the first order of business for the Congress and the President when they get back from summer vacation should be jobs. On Friday, the Center for American Progress released a report called Spurring Job Creation in the Private Sector, three elements that any jobs plan should have. The report is intended to give President Barack Obama direction as he tries to convince the GOP to stop obstructing his proposals. The three core recommendations from the proposal are investing in the nation's infrastructure by creating a new infrastructure bank, addressing the foreclosure crisis head-on, and assisting homes and businesses become more energy efficient. Donna Cooper explained that investing in infrastructure is spending domestically because it results in concrete, steel, and asphalt demand. She added that the previous stimulus shows that construction jobs benefit from infrastructure investments.
There is plenty of work and plenty of pent-up demand that once federal action is taken, states and localities can begin to pull the plans off the shelves and let the contracts, as they demonstrated they could do during the first stimulus package, and significantly improve their local economies.
California farm workers are on the march. Doug Cunningham reports.
Farm workers have begun a 200-mile march to California's state capital in Sacramento, pushing for enactment of the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. The 13-day march is an effort to win the right for farm workers to be paid overtime after 8 hours a day and 40 hours in a week like any other worker. Despite the support that labor unions give to Democratic politicians, California's Democratic Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act 2 months ago. Farm workers rallied at California's Capitol and some participated in hunger strikes in a vain effort to convince Brown to sign the legislation. If enacted, this legislation would also help protect farm workers from often brutal conditions in the fields, and it would make it easier for farm workers to join unions through a majority sign-up provision. 50 full-time marchers will be joined by other farm workers and their supporters throughout the 200-mile march route to Sacramento. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty. When we look into the eyes of our kids, cause brothers, it's fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us, let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as we follow, let's save some for tomorrow.
Is the goal that our children will have something so that we can look, they can look back at us and say, well, you know what, mom and dad didn't screw us too bad. Kind of like I look back on my grandparents and my parents, you know, they left us an infrastructure that was solid. They left us some pretty good stuff, and we have not, I don't know that we've taken care of it very well. My quote of the day comes from Michelle Bachmann, a Republican presidential candidate, who says the United States needs to be less dependent on foreign sources of energy and more dependent upon American resourcefulness. Whether that is in the Everglades or whether that's in the Eastern Gulf region or whether that's in North Dakota, we need to go where the energy is. So again, more drill, baby, drill. And I think we should be doing something else. So, you know, to help us work through some of that from the National Clean Energy Summit, I've got Kate Gordon. She's the Vice President of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress, and she's also co-director of the National Alliance of, or former co-director of the National Apollo Alliance. She's also a senior policy advisor there. Kate, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. It's great to be here.
So you're at the National Clean Energy Summit 4.0, the future of energy. Is the future drill, baby, drill?
I hope not. I mean, I like that Bachman quote because, you know, I like to think that American ingenuity can get us beyond these dirty fossil fuel sources and really get us moving on the right track toward energy. I think we do have the ingenuity and the entrepreneurship to do that here in America and not just buy it from China. And that's really what we're talking about at the summit.
Yeah. And part of me, you know, says, you know, you look at the natural gas here in central Pennsylvania and this Marcellus Shale. Yeah. I see it as a possible a transfer fuel, get us away from the dirty stuff, maybe move towards, you know, some renewables. Like I put solar panels on my house and I think they're fantastic. I would love to see, as my daughter says, solar panels on every Walmart and on every school in the country.
Well, I think that's, you know, I agree with you about natural gas. It's what it is in the next 10 to 20 years, if done responsibly, is really a transition fuel away from coal. And I think that's a really important thing about natural gas. But frankly, we have to transition beyond that too and get to a much bigger diversity of sources and get to much more renewable sources that we're not taking out of the ground. We need to get serious about the policy that's going to move us in that direction. That's what Senator Reid and Center for American Progress and others are trying to do at this summit, really trying to make the case again that we need to set a policy environment in this country that's going to get us on the right track, because otherwise, frankly, we will be stuck buying all of our supplies from China when we finally wake up to the reality of the need for a more diverse energy system here.
You know, here's the thing. I look back to the years when Carter was in office, and I thought they had the idea, you know, moving forward, you know, transition away from, you know, the dirty stuff, you know, to having policy that would, at some point down the line, make homes energy independent, buildings energy independent, which I know we have the technology. Today, we just don't have the political will.
That's right. It is so frustrating to look back over the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. You look at Nixon, you look at Carter, all these presidents have said, we need to get off of foreign oil, we need to become more independent, we need to have a more diverse supply of energy for our national security, and we just are not serious about it. Probably the most serious policy that we've done in this area was the Recovery Act of a couple of years ago, which was the single biggest domestic, you know, energy, clean energy spending program we've ever done. But we need to sustain that kind of thing if we're going to really see development and businesses really invest in this country in solar and wind and algae, biofuels, and all kinds of stuff that's out there.
You know, maybe you have an idea because, you know, some of the numbers that I've seen, you talk about the Recovery Act, but China, as I understand, is outspending us, you know, worlds apart on solar panels and wind and geothermal. Yeah. And all of that stuff that we should be full steam ahead on, yet I don't know that they have the lobbying problem that we do.
China has been amazing in this area. You know, say what you will about sort of the political situation there, but they have really invested in clean energy. There's a lot of different numbers get thrown around, but they're spending just probably 10 to 50 times more than we are on especially solar and wind. What they're trying to do is two things. They're trying to build up their national manufacturing base in those areas at the same time that they pass policies to make their own environment cleaner, which they desperately need to do. That's not to say we haven't made some advances here. I actually just saw numbers from the Solar Energy Industry Association today that show that we're a net exporter of solar right now. So we're actually exporting some solar components to China. We're also exporting some good battery technology and other automotive technology to China. So we really do have the ability to do it here. We have the ability to manufacture stuff here. We have the workforce to do it here. We have the ingenuity to do it here. And it's being done in those states that have really taken a strong stance on clean energy, but we're not doing it nearly to the extent China is when it comes to national commitment or national policy.
You know, one of the things that I've said that has to happen, and this could happen on the state levels with different building codes. We have the ability to mandate that a certain percentage of every new home built has to have renewable energy, and the goal down the road being that every home is off the grid, so to speak. They create all of their own energy, and we don't have to burn coal, and we don't have to burn oil, and all of the other things that we do.
That's absolutely right. I mean, what you're talking about, which is sort of a building code requirement that we become more energy independent, is exactly the kind of things that other countries are doing that are really surpassing us in clean energy development and in clean energy manufacturing. Places like China, the EU are saying, look, a certain amount of the energy coming from the utilities has to be renewable. Buildings have to be a certain level of efficiency and use renewable power. And those types of policies have really spurred some amazing ingenuity in the clean energy sectors in those countries and have really spurred manufacturing in particular and good permanent, you know, middle-class jobs in those countries. It's exactly the kind of policies. You're seeing them a little bit at the state level here, but we're just not seeing the national commitment.
Well, here's my problem, and I see 2012 as an important presidential year. I see this almost as 1980 over again. We have a small commitment moving forward to renewables, to solar, and to wind, and the whole thing. But 2012 could be that moment where another Reagan-esque person enters the White House and proverbially, you know, rips the solar panels off, saying we're sticking with oil and coal.
Right, or digs up the organic garden, right? No, that's absolutely right. It could be. I think we're seeing some very problematic language coming from a lot of the people, folks running, especially on the Republican side. You know, that's maybe not surprising. If you look at the numbers on donations to campaigns in the House, you see huge donations coming in from the oil and gas industry and the coal industry, you know, 89 to 95% of which are going to Republican candidates. So I'm not surprised we're seeing that language from the Republican field, but you know, we've got to get beyond it. There are people in the field who are being more pragmatic. Huntsman has said that he's in favor of more diverse and secure energy. I think we need to really, really, as voters and Americans, push all the candidates on both sides to really make this a central point, because we're risking our national security as well as our economic security if we keep putting our head in the sand on that.
Absolutely. And what I fear is all the movement that we've made forward in creating this green energy economy, these green jobs. 2012, you get a Republican in office. All those jobs die. That whole industry once again dies. I mean, we're the ones who invented this stuff back in the 70s, and now here we're going to give it up again.
Well, what's crazy is that it would be just a move backward. I mean, it really would take the country backward, and it would make us less competitive and less secure. And I just can't believe that voters would elect someone who would want to do that. We just have to make that a central point of this election.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the National Clean Energy Summit 4.0. what is the future of energy? I guess that's the theme of it. What are they saying?
Well, the summit is the fourth one we've done. Center for American Progress and our Action Fund, Partner Action Fund, co-host the summit with Senator Reid. And this year we're also co-hosting it with the Clean Energy Project and MGM, actually. And we're really trying to make the point that new energy technologies have created jobs and a stronger economy in Nevada and in the western states in general. We're really focused on sort of the economy of the western states this year. And we're trying to make the point that we need, as I said, a stronger commitment to clean energy policy to move the whole country's economy in that direction. So we're kind of looking at success stories from Nevada and the western states, and then we're also talking about what needs to be done at the national level to make us more secure and to make us economically stronger when it comes to energy. It should be exciting. We have Vice President Biden speaking this year, which we're very excited about. He's been so great on the need to really build up manufacturing in the middle class in particular, which is a big issue for me. It's why I got into this field, is because of the economic development potential and the potential to create good, strong middle class jobs. And we've also got some really great, a bunch of governors coming, which is great, including Governor Sandoval from Nevada and Governor Jerry Brown. So we're excited about the lineup. And I hope it'll really remind people that this is real, that green jobs exist, that many states are quite progressive on this and are moving forward, and that, you know, the nation needs to really take a cue from the states on this issue.
I agree. You know, when I look at this, going back to 2012, you know, there are a bunch of folks, myself included, who put solar panels on our house. We got the investment. I'll put that in. I'm afraid that, again, they ripped that away. And I look at what you guys are doing in this conference. The talk of some of the people I know in the western part of the country, they've done the same kind of things. They've put solar panels on their homes. They've invested in these alternative things. And now there are some of the folks I know kind of concerned.
Well, absolutely. I think what's great about the summit and why the Center for American Progress has continued to be involved in it year after year is that one thing that we try to do after every summit is really take the lessons learned and the issues that we bring up here and bring them back to the national stage. So the summits in the past have focused on a number of issues that have really come up in national legislation, including some positive parts of the Recovery Act and some pieces of like the Natural Gas Act and the Better Buildings Initiative that haven't passed out of Congress but that are going to be coming up again this Congress, and we'll just continue to push them. But we really see it as a way to bring those state success stories and local success stories to the national stage and really try to push this stuff at a much higher level with some pretty big name folks behind it.
Yeah, because there's a great opportunity here, and as you know, we've heard from a lot of our friends around the country, there's really the potential to get off of the foreign oil, to get off of the foreign juice, and to really be dominant in this century, because I do believe that the country that figures out how to be independent for their energy needs, they're going to be the ones that dominate.
Absolutely. I mean, both, you know, dominate in terms of being much more secure when it comes to energy blackouts, when it comes to attacks on energy systems. The more diversified we are, the better, frankly. But also, you know, we know from a recent Brookings report that the clean energy sector grew twice as fast as the rest of the American economy in the last 5 years. So this is a place where we can actually be economically growing instead of economically stagnant. So it's a real, there's a real opportunity in both those cases.
Yep. I'm anxious to see what comes out of this conference tomorrow, especially the part about achieving energy security and independence.
Yep.
Through collaboration and competition. I'm looking forward to see what comes out of that. I have a great conference. Thanks for giving us an update, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. Well, we're glad you're tuning in.
All right. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break.
Sure.
Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
If Rick Snyder ever comes to help you, run away as fast and as far as you can. Snyder is the right-wing corporate-hugging governor of Michigan, whose extremist anti-worker, anti-government agenda was handed to him by a Koch-funded front group named the Mackinac Center. Included in the package was a doozy of autocratic mischief-making called the Local Government Fiscal Accountability Act. The new law turned Snyder into a perverse hybrid of a Soviet czar and a ten-horned banana republic potentate, and it has infuriated the public. Now trying to backpedal, the governor's new line is that it's about helping communities. Helping? This law allows him to seize control of any city, county, school district, etc., that he decides is in fiscal trouble, authorizing him to appoint an emergency manager, which may be a private corporation, to run the entity. This autocratic regent is empowered to cancel labor contracts, repeal the public budget, privatize government assets, dismiss elected officials, and even dissolve the local entity. This is the kind of help that a fox brings to the hen house. So the governor is now being sued by his own astonished citizenry. Snyder's tyrannical law, they point out, violates the state's constitution by usurping the right of local residents to elect their officials. As the director of a community legal group in Detroit puts it, the governor's designated emergency manager would control all, including the right to enact or repeal local ordinances. This is Jim Hightower saying, you might be thinking, thank goodness I don't live in Michigan. But if Snyder's anti-democratic coup succeeds there, you can bet that various Koch-backed right-wing front groups will bring the Michigan model to your state. For information on the Michigan fight, contact Detroit's Sugar Law Center at www.sugarlaw.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside there's feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you hugged a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love? Yeah.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out our website at thericksmithshow.com. Well, so Snow White was out on the stump in Florida talking to voters, and, well, this gem fell out of her mouth.
And I don't know how much God has to do to get the attention of the politicians. We've had an earthquake. We've had a hurricane. He said, are you going to start listening to me here? Listen to the American people.
Yeah, listen to the American people. I'm sure God wants everybody to listen to the American people. And, you know, what I find interesting about this is how she assumes, and I love this about radical right-wing religious people, they naturally assume that however they want to choose to use whatever happens is how God wanted it done. Now, look, at least 33 people died over the weekend due to this. At least 33. Did anybody ever stop and think that maybe the earthquake and the hurricane was God's way of saying, hey, you people need to come together and take care of one another. You need to make sure that everyone of my children are being properly cared for, that you have government who's able to get those people out in time to have an infrastructure to make sure that folks are taken care of. Did anyone ever think that maybe instead of this whole, well, the reason the earthquakes are coming is because the gays. It's the gays that did it. We know. You know, how do we know it's not the other way around? No one ever asked that question. So I have just done that. And I think I saw this. Someone sent us an email. One of the kids, I forget where it was, but he, for his project, his art project for school, it looked like a cake almost. And it says, squirrels love Michelle Bachmann because she's nuts. You gotta love that.
That's pretty funny.
Speaking of nuts, you know, remember on Friday we talked about this Ted Borowski guy. He's the chief oil and gas geologist at the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources here in the state of Pennsylvania. And he was talking to a group of insurance underwriters down in Lancaster County last week, and he said something that, you know, caught the attention of a bunch of folks, especially Representative Josh Shapiro. He said that Joseph Goebbels would be proud of the movie Gasland, because it looks at the impact that natural gas drilling is going to have on people and on the state, and on, especially on the people who, when they turn their faucets on, they can light their water on fire. I think that's pretty important. He went on to say that the film was, you know, a beautiful piece of propaganda and should receive the Nazi Award. And I look at this and I go, you know, is this really the language you want from a state official? Is this the kind, is this how far our politic has gone to the extreme right? That to question what happens in the state somehow is akin to being a Nazi. I think this guy should be fired. Honestly and truthfully, this is not the kind of rhetoric you want coming out of a state official. My tax dollars should not be going to someone like that. Now, you say, well, you're overreacting. No, I don't think so. When you have an honest concern, for instance, there was some talk after the earthquake that there was a potential that the fracking may have caused this. And, of course, you know, the industry is saying, no, no, that's like comparing apples and orangutans. That's going to stick with me, I think, for a very long time. And how dare you ask a question? Like, could the fracking and, the, you know, these chemicals were pumping underground at high pressure and causing these explosions, could this possibly have moved the plates a little bit and caused slippage and caused these earthquakes? Evidently, the industry says it's ludicrous, and we've got a guy who works for the state who says, you know, this movie questioning this is Nazi propaganda. So I would assume that probably this guy would look at anybody like me who would ask the question, is it possible, you know, that this could be happening? Maybe I'm spewing Nazi propaganda, according to him. When the reality is we know emphatically that by pumping this stuff underground, we know that it causes low-level seismic activity. We know that. It's been proven time and time again. Now, does fracking do it? Don't know. Inconclusive at this point. In fact, some experts have looked at this. This guy, Mark Zoback, who was cited in this San Francisco Chronicles piece, talking about just this, said, you know, fracking may have some cause to the process, but what it was, when they looked at their study, it was the disposal. It was this disposal of the fracking fluid after it had pumped back out. Also, they looked at some small earthquakes in Dallas in 2008, 2009, where the same kind of thing had happened. So it wasn't the fracking that did it. It was the disposal. And this is what we talked about last week a little bit. You know, in Colorado, in Rangeley, Colorado, back in the 60s, they found same kind of thing when they were pumping this stuff underground at high pressures. And if it was near the tectonic plates, it could cause some slippage. And in the article, the guy, you know, kind of likens it to an air hockey table. You push a bunch of air into the table, and, you know, eventually it's got to come out. And something's going to move, and it causes a slip. You know, how the puck goes across the air. Same kind of thing. And so when you're talking about could it possibly have been, I don't know that it's apples and orangutans, Jake. I think you're in the ballpark.
Well, here's another thing, Rick, and we both know this is true. It hasn't been around long enough to really know the effects of the chemicals, how it affects food, how it affects water supply. The jury's very much out yet on how safe this, not only how safe this industry is making the process, but how safe the process itself of getting this natural gas out of the ground.
You know, you look at Arkansas, for instance. They have put a moratorium on this disposal of frac fluids. A moratorium because they had hundreds, if not a thousand, of these low-level seismic earthquakes. These low, and, you know, the one, I guess, the largest reached 4.7 magnitude. And what they came down with, what they think it is it's this high-pressure stuff, this pushing underground. And you look at California, this fracking is happening in California as well, and there's some talk, you know, California, really? You know, with all of the earthquake activity there, you're going to start this? And the article points to this woman, Renee Sharp. She's the director of California's Environmental Working Group. She's saying that a California state bill that would have forced companies to disclose the chemicals that they used for fracking originally contained a clause that would have required the companies to report whether the wells they planned to frack were near any well-known fault lines. Now, this is the part that I love. The clause was taken out of in a compromise with the gas and oil industry. Now, she says, I'd like to see that adopted at some point in the future, but again, the lobbyists have done a masterful job of putting in their important stuff.
Well, and then you have a governor, and he's done some, in my mind, some questionable things. He set up this oversight committee that just happened to be dominated by, you know, corporate people within the industry. Even though, to be fair, there were a number of environmental groups represented. However, the power base is with the industry itself. In other words, this governor has a philosophy of self-policing, pretty much.
Well, I mean, it is the radical right position. At the end of the day, they're going to let this industry do whatever it wants because they see it as they're tying it to their political futures. If this industry booms, if it creates jobs, the Republicans will take over, that whole area of the state for years and years to come. They will be, and they're tying it to their political fortunes. It's pretty simple to see it that way. And your water be damned, your environment be damned. If it gets messed up, we'll deal with that. We'll deal with it down the road. Let somebody else clean it up. I mean, all you have to do is look at the coal industry. When we allowed them to strip mine, when we allowed them to get out of hand. Now, look, I'm in favor of the coal miners doing the job of the coal miner, which is to go underground and do it in an environmentally responsible way. You know, the whole strip mining and the whole blowing tops of mountains off, I'm not overly thrilled with, especially with the side effects, all that slurry that they're holding behind, huge dams that, at any day, they're not saying if, they're saying when these things cut loose are going to take out small towns. It seems to me to be just insane. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about unemployment compensation insurance. Here in the state, they're talking about changing the laws again. When we come back, Michael Evangelist will be here. He's a national policy analyst for the National Employment Law Project. Back after this.
Don't know much about the branch I took, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. There's a $1 million man. Always it's his way.
I crack up every time I hear that guy. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Well, the days are counting down until the Pennsylvania General Assembly returns to jumpstart the attacks on workers across our state. We will be seeing a number of toxic bills being rammed through. There's the voter ID bill that's going to solve a problem that doesn't exist. The workers' comp bill that's going to ensure 95% of injured workers never see their own doctor. The No Rights at Work agenda pushed by Madcow himself, and of course the unemployment comp bill, designed to steal compensation away from workers when they need it the most. And I guess that's the point. And the fact that we're even talking about stripping benefits away from workers who are thrown out of their jobs tells me we have shifted our priorities considerably over the last 30 years. Here to talk about that and the state of unemployment around the country is Michael Evangelist. He is a policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick.
You know, I look across the state here, and we've already had one attack on unemployment comp, and I look across the country, and it seems like the mostly Republican-led legislatures have been going after unemployment compensation, put that in their crosshairs, and you guys have done a study pointing out some of that stuff.
Sure. In Pennsylvania, thus far, you've been relatively unscathed. Michigan, we've had some of the worst cuts and some of the first, actually. As you know, a lot of states have had to borrow to pay unemployment insurance benefits throughout the recession, and the magnitude of borrowing in Michigan has been pretty extreme. We owe $3.1 billion, and that's the highest per capita. And we were also the first state to borrow. We actually borrowed before the recession started, unlike any other state. And the solution here has been cut worker benefits. And back in March, the state chopped 6 weeks off of regular state benefits. So since the 1950s, Michigan and pretty much every other state has offered at least 26 weeks of benefits. And Michigan became the first state to cut 6 weeks off. A couple other states followed suit. Florida even had a tougher benefit week cut. South Carolina cut 6 weeks. Arkansas, Illinois both cut 1 week. So something that we're seeing throughout the country. But Michigan definitely led the way, and we, like Pennsylvania, have more cuts coming down the pike. They're moving through our legislature very quickly.
Yeah, and I look at Michigan, and Michigan's really a perfect example. I remember when Pennsylvania had the surplus, they had their rainy day fund, and they were hell-bent on we need to get rid of that, need to return it to the taxpayers, needed to return it in, tax breaks for, rich people. And, the general consensus now seems to be that we need to, cut benefits and give tax breaks to the corporations who are pocketing the savings and not hiring people. And I look at Michigan, another, like I said, a perfect example.
Yeah, one thing that we focused on in the report, particularly for our state lawmakers who are term limited, is some historical tax breaks that have been given. So I don't think there's an institutional knowledge in our state legislature that's really required to understand this issue. So back in 1995, the state cut employer taxes, and this is when our state was just starting to recover from the 1980s recession. And basically, over 5 years, employers saved $750 million in taxes. And the same bill that cut taxes also put a cap on benefits. So workers gave up about $350 million over that same time period. And then in 2002, our trust funds actually reached a peak in 2000 and started to decline. In 2002, they cut taxes further. And then that just kind of picked up the pace of the declining reserves.
Again, you look at this, and what I've been saying for the longest time, this ideology of cut taxes, cut, has really left this country in a deep hole. Because, general consensus, like anybody would run their own household finances, is when times are good, you put money away, like the squirrel, you put some nuts away for the winter. Yet we seem to have this idea that, during good times we give all the money to the very wealthy and we give it away to all the businesses because we want to be business friendly. But during tough times, the people who are struggling have to struggle that much more.
Yeah, and I'd say even in the good times, we're still giving away. In Michigan, the state, as part of the state budget, they enacted a $1.6 billion business tax cut, $1.6 billion. And they're paying for that through pretty much the elimination of the state earned income tax credit. That's a tax credit that goes to working families, so you have to work to get it, and it goes to people with children. So they more or less eliminated that. They've cut state spending for education, and they also decided to tax senior pensions. So in all, taxes on regular people will increase by about $1.4 billion to pay for that employer tax break.
Yeah, I just don't understand. I just don't understand how it is that, especially in a state like Michigan, that you could end up with someone like Rick Snyder. I'm struggling with this. How it is you can end up with a radical legislature and a radical governor. I'm sorry, I'm just not getting it.
Well, I think unemployment insurance is a good example of how this can happen. Workers don't know about these cuts, really, until they actually go to claim benefits. So our state cut, the 6 weeks that I just spoke about, that was packaged together in a bill that allowed the state to offer federal benefits. So for a while there, it looked like we were going to lose 20 weeks of federal benefits, and they packaged the two things together, so this permanent tax or permanent reduction in benefit weeks with this temporary federal benefits that the state didn't have to pay for at all. And the governor's press release only mentioned the federal benefits, didn't even talk about the permanent slashing to the weeks of benefits that are available on an ongoing basis. If he was proud of extending the federal benefits, he should have been equally as proud of cutting them and, talked about that.
Absolutely.
But he didn't. And people don't have the information that they need.
Yeah, I look at this and I wonder why we're not seeing the modern day version of Coxey's Army, where the unemployed of the 1880s, 1890s marched their way from Massillon, Ohio, to Washington D.C. and sat down and said, "We got nothing else to do. When are you going to start creating jobs? When are you going to start helping us?" Why aren't we seeing that kind of activism? Why aren't we seeing the unemployed? I know people who have been unemployed since Bush was president, who still cannot find a job. Why aren't we seeing people running to the streets screaming?
Well, you know, we've seen the power of Twitter and Facebook to organize people in the Middle East, but it doesn't seem to have taken effect here. You know, I think that those social media, they just can't replace standing in an unemployment insurance line waiting to collect your benefits and seeing your neighbors there and feeling like you're going through this with someone else and that you're not the only one. You know, I ran into a neighbor the other day who, I guess she's a computer programmer and has been out of work and waitressing. And, you know, I had no idea she was going through that until she told me. So it's that type of thing that, you know, you kind of miss when you're not staying there with people in line collecting unemployment insurance benefits and talking and getting organized.
Yeah, it is an excellent point, and I've brought it up in the past because, you know, that's where I remember one time when I was unemployed. You went down there, and there are other people like you, and you had the opportunity to converse and maybe do some organizing around the fact that you wanted a job. And there's part of me that thinks it was by design that they broke up these offices. It was by design that they've put unemployment compensation as a telephone call or an internet thing so that people aren't together, so that we've sliced and diced and divided folks away from each other and put them in the corners.
Well, and that could be, you know, I really don't know. I mean, it seems like there's obvious savings in having the internet and telephone, but then at the same time, not only do you lose that human contact with your fellow unemployed workers, you don't have the interface with the state employment agencies.
Yep.
So when you had to claim benefits, you know, you could go in and actually see someone and potentially get some help, and you know, that help isn't there right now. A lot of those services have been outsourced to private companies that more or less aren't working on getting people jobs. So you lose that benefit of not having people come in the office, and you get some possible cost savings in the short term. But
you got to love privatization.
That's right.
Yeah, and again, you know, the more we look at what's going on the last 30 years of Republican rule and right-wing policy, this is what it's brought us to. And all I keep hearing is we need to do more of the same thing that put us into this mess. You know, I go back to the tax reform bill of 86, where they started taxing unemployment benefits. First time they'd done that. We want to talk about a slap in the face. And now they're talking about reducing those benefits, reducing the weeks, making it more difficult. Some states wanting to drug test people. I mean, it's just nuts.
Yeah, I'd say it's, you know, I don't have as much historical perspective, perhaps, but I think this situation is actually a little bit unique and worse than it was before. You know, certainly this isn't the first time in Michigan we've had a Republican governor and Republican-led legislature, and unemployment insurance benefits have managed to remain relatively intact all those years. So I think we have something special going on right now, unfortunately.
Well, I think it's the radicalization of the right. They see an opportunity to crush the working class of this country. And the security that comes with unemployment compensation is one of those key safety nets that they want to take out, because they want a desperation class of people who will work for food.
Well, we're definitely heading in that direction.
No, I mean, doesn't it seem that way? I mean, to me, that's what it looks like. Every safety net program that's out there, every safety net that saved this nation from depression in 2008, is what they're going after.
Yeah, that's right. They definitely are, and I don't know what to do to prevent that from happening, unfortunately.
Well, what it is it's start with reports like yours to point out the fact that these states have gone after these workers, have cut unemployment benefits. You know, like you pointed out, there's Michigan, there's Missouri, South Carolina, down to 20 weeks from 26. Arkansas dropped a week. Florida, 12 weeks, possibly. I'm gonna
That's
not
right.
Really? Is this how bad it's gotten that we're going to smack somebody when they're down this badly? And the answer evidently is yes, because we need more tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And you, who did nothing wrong, got kicked to the curb, well, you're going to have to pay the freight.
And, yeah, there is actually a federal solution to the unemployment insurance problem, but it hasn't gotten a lot of traction yet. And that would actually short-term forgive a lot of the state debt, actually give some tax breaks for employers, but also ensure the long-term solvency of the rainy day funds in each state.
Yeah.
And require states to maintain a healthy balance in that. So, you know, there'd be some short-term benefits for employers, but then a long-term focus on fixing the system. And no one is really talking about this federal solution. And, you know, frankly, in a state like Michigan where the problem is so deep, I think a federal solution is really, really necessary and would definitely help everyone in this state.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a federal solution, I think a federal solution would be to cap benefits at 26 weeks and not have any extensions other than government be the employer of last resort. And you give people jobs, you get them back to work so that they wake up every day with something to do, because I firmly believe that work has therapeutic qualities. It gives you something to do, some self-respect, some dignity, and that's how we get this economy going again. Not by continual unemployment, but by getting people back to work.
I agree that you know, there definitely needs to be something after unemployment insurance benefits. I see the value in the extensions, and that you do have some, you know, highly skilled workers. I mean, here in Michigan, we have a bunch of engineers that were laid off from the car companies. And if they sit out long enough, they will eventually find work, and it might take longer than 26 weeks in a recession. But I think it's important to give those people those extra weeks and that opportunity to get back to work. But, you know, if people don't find a job, then I agree with you 100% that there needs to be some sort of federal backstop where, hey, I want to work, and you have the opportunity to do that.
Well, I mean, these folks with specialized skills, we couldn't use them, we the people. You couldn't put engineers to work, you know, maybe rebuilding levees or some of the things that we need to have in this country infrastructurally improved?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Again, I think I'd still have the extensions, and then, you know, they would have time to find a job in the private sector, and if they couldn't, then that opportunity would be made available at some point.
Interesting point. Michael Evangelist, I appreciate the time. Policy analyst, National Employment Law Project. We've got a link at our website, thericksmithshow.com, to their piece. Just click on Michael's name. It'll take you right there. Mike, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. Keep up the great work.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. More working people come to talk. Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Things are kind of upside down.
He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane.
Still, again, every time I hear you play that, I still don't know what it is he has done, and I don't know that I want him doing it again. So we need to get some clarification on this. What did he do? When did he do it? And well, why? And do we really want him doing it again? I don't think so. Anyway, this weekend on Saturday, you know, while the East Coast was being slammed by Irene, the Georgia Republicans held their statewide straw poll, and the Herman Cain train railed its way to a first-place finish with 26% of the vote, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, beating Texas Congressman Ron Paul, who came in second with 23 votes, Rick Perry, you know, a respectable third with 20 votes, and poor Newt Gingrich finishing fourth with 18 votes. Now, understand, former Speaker of the House was from Georgia as well, so you would think a little street cred there, he'd have gotten a little something. Mitt Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, fifth place, 6% of the vote. And, of course, Michelle Bachmann got 3%. Poor Tricky Ricky Santorum, he got 1%, along with John Huntsman, Thad McCotter, Buddy Romer, and Gary Johnson, who, I got to be honest, Thad McCotter, Buddy Romer, Gary Johnson, I didn't know they were still in it. I thought they had taken the hiatus out. So the whole Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs frame, if you use the Georgia numbers, way out the window. It's like now 12 dwarfs. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. It's going to come down, I think, to a couple. I think it's either going to be Romney or Perry at this point. I think if you know, the big guy there in New Jersey decides to throw his helicopter into the ring, well, he may be flavor of the month, jump right up to first place there. Interestingly enough, and this is one of those, you know, there's part of me that's rethinking my prediction that Rick Perry is going to take it, because he is just so stupid. I mean, he keeps doing the dumbest things, stepping into the biggest piles that he can find. And, you know, this weekend, again, one of the dumbest things, I think everybody understands, and I hope you understand, Social Security was an anti-poverty insurance program. That's settled, isn't it, Jake? I mean, we've kind of figured that out. It's anti-poverty insurance for old people.
That's absolutely true, and I believe most Americans realize that.
Rick Perry, however, he believes, when he was asked a very simple question, he said the current administration, especially lately, I've been noticing on TV, that's what they're promoting it as. The question is, what it originally started out to be is not an entitlement program. Americans who are working, putting money into it. And Perry says, you know, here's the reality. It was a retirement program. And actually, it's turned into a tax now. So it completely does not know the history, does not know the original intent, does not know the legislation at all. And it's quite shocking to me that someone who would be running for president would be this radically misinformed. But then again, I look at Sarah Palin, I look at Michelle Bachmann, and I'm not really surprised. These are not great intellects. These are not geniuses. And I guess this is what is attractive to the extreme right. Someone who, just like me, someone I'd like to have a beer with, someone I'd like to take a walk in the park with. I don't want that. I don't want me. I don't want someone like me running for the highest office in the land. I would like somebody who's really smart, who really has the ability to grasp very, very complex issues, and to be able to make decisions based on information and not what they believe. See, I believe. It's a Ponzi scheme, he says. Ponzi scheme. It's a monstrosity. And I go, really? Really, Rick? You know that thing that keeps my grandmother out of poverty? You're going to call that a monstrosity? When the reality is, and we know this, without Social Security, over half of the people over 65 in this country would be in poverty. Over half. Thanks to Social Security, thanks to smart programs and good policy, fewer than 10% of the people who are above 65 live in poverty. That, to me, is a very successful program. It has been mismanaged, it has been mishandled, and it's been, really honestly and truthfully, if you really look at it, it has been the Republican side of the aisle with some help from the Democrats. But if you go back to the Reagan years, they set this thing up where they're going to have the Social Security Trust Fund. We're going to set this baby up, and then we can borrow from it so that it doesn't make our budget deficits look as big. Because back in the 80s, people were doing the same thing that they're doing now, complaining about these massive budget deficits, because they were really something new. I mean, you're taking on this massive debt at a time that we're not at war, kind of unprecedented. Now, understand, they made it seem like we had to fight this war with the Soviets because we need to build up our Star Wars, and we need to have defense shields, and we need to have missiles and all kind of stuff. Basically just cronyism, handing it off to the big military contractors, which we did very well. I think we did a very nice job enriching the military industrial complex. The problem is they took that money from Social Security, and now, like Bush told you back in 2004, those filing cabinets just have a bunch of IOUs. Problem is, those IOUs, that's full faith and credit of the federal government, and, as Alan Simpson pointed out, is the money that was Social Security. I think they've been pretty honest about that.
I think so.
So, again, you know, I look at this, and it scares me to think that a guy who could be president has this kind of misinformation. It's kind of dangerous to me. Kind of a dangerous thought. Finally, Newt Gingrich, evidently Newty. You remember when Newty got glitter bombed? He was the first guy to get glitter bombed as the gay folk came through and they had their glittering of him, which, you know, I thought kind of dumb, especially when you're talking about somebody who's got, you know, security who could, you know, pretty much snap you into. At first he brushed it off, said, yeah, it's nice to live in a free country. Now he's kind of changing his tune on that and actually wants people to be, you know, prosecuted for this. He says, you know, glitter bombing is clearly an assault and should be treated as such. And, you know, I got to be honest. You know, when I first saw it happen, when I first saw Gingrich get it, I said there should have been a security person fired. When I saw Michelle Bachmann get it, I said, they're really, and you may remember, especially the Bachmann clip, when, really, you're going to let someone run at a presidential candidate like that? Just amazing. I think it's wrong to be throwing glitter at people. I think it's funny. I will laugh every time it happens, but I think it's wrong.
And I think you lose, even if you, even for, you lose sympathy from people who even agree with you on her. But I think you're right.
It's still funny.
It is funny, but you know what? You can call attention to her absurdities in a lot more responsible ways.
But Newt Gingrich finishing fourth in his home state, I mean, that's got to be enough for him to go, you know, I got glitter bombed, I'm fourth in my own state.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, we talked about this several times. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the Newtster's hanging on to make money. You know, give him a little more publicity, perhaps get in a couple more debates, sell more books, buy more of his paraphernalia. And with a wife like that, do you blame him?
Well, I mean
she likes to spend money.
Sure,
she likes to spend money. I mean, she's young and attractive, and, you know, she likes the finer things in life, you know, and the neuter's got to find money to, you know, sustain his standard of living. So, I mean, as far as presidential, I mean, it's pretty much a joke.
Yeah, he's done. But again, you know, fourth in his own state there is really a kick in the pants. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Rick Perry, a little bit more about this whole right-wing attack machine and the direction it's taking. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Most Americans agree that the first order of business for the Congress and the President when they get back from summer vacation should be jobs. On Friday, the Center for American Progress released a report called Spurring Job Creation in the Private Sector, three elements that any jobs plan should have. The report is intended to give President Barack Obama direction as he tries to convince the GOP to stop obstructing his proposals. The three core recommendations from the proposal are investing in the nation's infrastructure by creating a new infrastructure bank, addressing the foreclosure crisis head-on, and assisting homes and businesses become more energy efficient. Donna Cooper explained that investing in infrastructure is spending domestically because it results in concrete, steel, and asphalt demand. She added that the previous stimulus shows that construction jobs benefit from infrastructure investments.
There is plenty of work and plenty of pent-up demand that once federal action is taken, states and localities can begin to pull the plans off the shelves and let the contracts, as they demonstrated they could do during the first stimulus package, and significantly improve their local economies.
California farm workers are on the march. Doug Cunningham reports.
Farm workers have begun a 200-mile march to California's state capital in Sacramento, pushing for enactment of the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. The 13-day march is an effort to win the right for farm workers to be paid overtime after 8 hours a day and 40 hours in a week like any other worker. Despite the support that labor unions give to Democratic politicians, California's Democratic Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act 2 months ago. Farm workers rallied at California's Capitol and some participated in hunger strikes in a vain effort to convince Brown to sign the legislation. If enacted, this legislation would also help protect farm workers from often brutal conditions in the fields, and it would make it easier for farm workers to join unions through a majority sign-up provision. 50 full-time marchers will be joined by other farm workers and their supporters throughout the 200-mile march route to Sacramento. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Pay too much taxes, the poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Interesting quote. You might want to guess who this is from. This deplorable act of treasonous deceit circumvents the balance of power established by our founding fathers in Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, established to protect all 50 states against invasion, halting the deportation process. To individually review each and every deportation case is a premeditated executive action to obstruct all deportations in favor of blanket amnesty. Yes, that's our own mad cow, Daryl Metcalf, who, going after the president, because, we want to be able to just round up anybody who looks like they don't belong here and ship them out. And what I thought was hysterical, we were over at the at Leroy Zimmerman's office down on Market Street in Harrisburg, and the woman I was there with is a member of SEIU and one of their higher up folks, and the security guard said, I've known Leroy Zimmerman longer than you've been in this country, and she goes, I was born in this country. And again, you know, I listened to the guy, and he would round up a whole lot of them, throw everybody out, even her, because she was with them. So, you know, again, you know, when you look at this immigration thing, you let people like Daryl Metcalf have his way, and they grab, take everybody, take them all, ship them all out, and we'll deal with it on the other side of the border. He's kind of nuts. In fact, not just kind of nuts, he's really nuts. But it's this talk of treason. And, you know, if you remember, you know, back on August 16th, Rick Perry, you know, was talking about Ben Bernanke. And, you know, talking about, you know, it's treasonous, and if he prints any more money, in Texas, he wouldn't be treated very friendly. You know, what he's doing is treasonous. And it's kind of nuts, but it is their way. And it's kind of how the whole discussion is now going. Because if you remember, first it was Obama and the Democrats, they're un-American. They're not like us. They're un-American. And now it's treasonous. And stop and think about where this thing has taken us and how this interesting and dangerous flip is going to play out over the next several months. Because we're going to hear this frame again and again and again. Because it didn't really catch. The whole un-American thing, not so much. Maybe with the birthers. Maybe with the extreme right of the Republican Party, maybe it caught there. But for mainstream America, not so much. So they need to keep pushing out this frame of, well, it's treasonous. And you hear a bunch of folks doing this. So I'm wondering, you know, I haven't seen the official playbook from the Heritage Foundation, but I'm kind of wondering if that's not the, think tank tested, focus group tested think tank approved messaging. If that's not where we're heading. Which is down the aisle of everything that the Democrats do, those evil Democrats. Treason! Treason! Not so sure. So Mad Cow, again, you know, when they come back, one of the things that we're going to be pushing through is the voter ID bill. And the Secretary of the Commonwealth, Carol Akles, I guess her name is, she had some interesting things to say in trying to push through the voter, you know, looking for a solution to a problem that really does not exist. But she said something that really caught my attention. We need to push the bill through because of 2000. And I said, really, when did 2000 play into this? You know, the voter fraud that happened in 2000. And I kind of questioned that because really, honestly, and truthfully, this would have nothing to do with the voter fraud that took place in 2000. She said in a telephone interview, this is according to the Patriot News, the bill would help restore confidence in the election system that was shaken by the recount in the 2000 election. She says it's another layer of security. It would make it harder for people to commit fraud. She says, I've worked in polling places since 1981, and I've never seen voter fraud. Now, this is right from her lips. I have worked in polling places since 1981, and I have never seen it. I've never seen the fraud, never seen it happen. The system is working. But maybe a brother-in-law owns a picture ID company. Maybe a brother-in-law owns the laminate. I don't know. But we need to do this for security, for confidence in the election. Because after all, you know, when you go to a hotel or you rent a car or you get on a plane, you buy a drink, you know, you got to get a train ticket. You know, you got to have photo identification. And my only response to that is, the people who don't have identification right now are people who generally don't have the money to go buy a drink, who generally don't have the money to board a plane or purchase a train ticket or do any of the things that she was talking about. My grandmother, for instance, does not have a photo ID. Her driver's license suspended years ago. She hasn't driven in years. She shouldn't be behind the wheel of a car. But they want her to go. And this is how this would work. They want her to go during certain hours of the day, you know, 9 to 12, 15, and 1 to 3, to go downtown, you know, some 20 miles from her home without any transportation, without any way of getting there, during hours when any family member couldn't do it. somehow she's supposed to go down there and get this voter ID. Now, understand, the city that she lives in, the city of Brooklyn, Ohio, where she lives, they have a shuttle that will come pick her up on voting day, take her to vote. That shuttle won't take you down to get the voter ID. Now, if we're talking about paying for that, maybe there's an idea. But I don't hear anybody saying we're going to make sure that everybody gets to the location to get their ID. Oh, no, wait a minute. We did hear someone. What was her name? Oh, yeah. The governor with the greatest porn name in history, Nikki Haley, said that she would personally drive any person who couldn't make it to the voter ID place to get their little voter ID. She would personally drive them until someone called her on it. And then she changed her mind and said, no, sorry, I'm busy that day. Maybe washing her hair. But I look at this, and again, what this is to me is it's a solution in search of a problem. If you really want to get to the bottom of what happened in 2000, maybe we go after the people who did the voter caging. Maybe we go after the people who scrubbed the voter rolls. Maybe we go after the people who put out all of the misinformation, like we saw in Wisconsin with the Koch brother front group, who just happened to, it was a minor typo. Just a minor typo. You know, instead of, you know, the voter being on, I forget what day it was on a completely other day. And, you know, you could make the argument, oh, it was a typo, but it was two letters instead of two numbers instead of one, which I don't know how you typo that, but you know, it was an honest mistake. Could happen to anybody. Could happen to anybody, really. But that's the manure that they're shoveling. And of course, I love that she had to throw Acorn into the mix. Well, you know, Acorn. Which let me tell you about Acorn. The fraud that was committed was not Acorn against the voting public. The fraud was committed against Acorn. They sent people out to get voter registrations. They said, we're paying you for a day to go out and let people sign up and bring those back. So people, you know, went out and said, well, let's open the phone book and we'll just write down some names. That sounds reasonable. This way we don't have to do anything. We'll get paid for the day. Everybody's happy. Who knows the difference? Acorn then figured this out, said, uh-oh, we got a problem. They actually reported it. In numerous places across the country, they reported that they were being defrauded. And part of me says that their honesty is what got them sunk. Now, are there a handful of situations where you could say that that someone did something wrong? Well, maybe. But I haven't seen a whole slew of convictions. Sorry. And you know what? All of those so-called violations, all of those violations, if you really went and prosecuted them, then you went and looked at what happened, no votes were cast. So it's kind of hard to say that this is going to solve the problem that doesn't exist. Unless you've got a different opinion.
No, I don't. Just an observation. She's talking about the year 2000. If you remember what happened, in Florida where a whole bunch of people were denied the right to vote because their name happened to be the same as a convicted felon?
Yeah, I think I said that with the whole purging.
Well, because what you happened, mentioned purging, but I don't know that you mentioned convicted felons, but that was...
No, that's they were purged off the list.
That was key.
Well, that's the purging. You know, they hired a for-profit company who didn't do the background work. They didn't do the due diligence. They just started throwing people off. Oh, yeah, you sound like a felon. In fact, in one case, they found a guy. In fact, they were very clairvoyant that there was going to be a guy. And I forget what his name was, but in 7 years, he was going to be a convicted felon. So because of that, you know, obviously they know in 7 years that he's going to be a convicted felon. They scratched him off the list for 2000. I mean, really? Yeah, that's what they did. They scrubbed some 90,000 people off the rolls. And those people didn't vote. And I understand Florida was a couple hundred votes. That's it. If those 90,000 mostly black people, and I love how Greg Palast frames it, the crime was voting while black, would have voted for Gore. I doubt many of them were going to vote for Pat Buchanan. I doubt that. And I really don't think a lot of them would have voted for George W. Bush. I just don't think so, which is why they purged them. And then the whole caging thing, a whole nother scheme. So if you look at all the votes in Florida and Ohio that were defrauded. This stuff, this voter ID does nothing, nothing at all to fix that. Nothing. But, you know, they keep throwing that out there. Keep throwing it. We're going to keep it safe. We're going to keep you safe. We're going to keep your election safe.
I mean, if you want to really do something about election fraud, the people that, and by the way, you don't have to go to Florida. They were right here in the capital of Pennsylvania in 2004. Going in high-performance Democratic districts, posting signs, Wednesday, you know, November, whatever it was, the next day after the election, knocking on senior citizens' doors, and you might say, well, who would believe it? They'd knock on senior citizens' doors and say, sorry, you can't vote, you're disqualified, and they'd give them a bogus reason.
Or they now, move your polling place or any
or
of
Or they moved your polling place, and a lot of seniors are intimidated easily. Now, if you want to eliminate that, let's put into the law automatic 5 years, anybody caught doing that. Those who are responsible and are funding those will be brought to justice. Seems to me those kind of efforts, I'm sure some have been brought to justice, but I don't know of any, and I'm sure that there are very few that have been brought to justice. But yet, they are making conscious efforts. And they are bringing, by the way, Rick, those people in from other states to hold down the vote. Who held them responsible? What penalty did they pay? Who investigated them? There should have been a congressional investigation on that.
Well, I think...
I never heard of any.
I think Paul Weyrich said it best.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So as many people as they can hold from voting, the better chance they have to win. It's that simple. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
If Rick Snyder ever comes to help you, run away as fast and as far as you can. Snyder is the right-wing corporate-hugging governor of Michigan, whose extremist anti-worker, anti-government agenda was handed to him by a Koch-funded front group named the Mackinac Center. Included in the package was a doozy of autocratic mischief-making called the Local Government Fiscal Accountability Act. The new law turned Snyder into a perverse hybrid of a Soviet czar and a ten-horned banana republic potentate, and it has infuriated the public. Now trying to backpedal, the governor's new line is that it's about helping communities. Helping? This law allows him to seize control of any city, county, school district, etc. that he decides is in fiscal trouble, authorizing him to appoint an emergency manager, which may be a private corporation, to run the entity. This autocratic regent is empowered to cancel labor contracts, repeal the public budget, privatize government assets, dismiss elected officials, and even dissolve the local entity. This is the kind of help that a fox brings to the hen house. So the governor is now being sued by his own astonished citizenry. Snyder's tyrannical law, they point out, violates the state's constitution by usurping the right of local residents to elect their officials. As the director of a community legal group in Detroit puts it, the governor's designated emergency manager would control all, including the right to enact or repeal local ordinances. This is Jim Hightower saying, you might be thinking, thank goodness I don't live in Michigan. But if Snyder's anti-democratic coup succeeds there, you can bet that various Koch-backed right-wing front groups will bring the Michigan model to your state. For information on the Michigan fight, contact Detroit's Sugar Law Center at www.sugarlaw.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Ron writes me, the first results of Governor Rick Scott's drug testing regimen in Florida are in, and as we talked about last week, only 2% of the people they tested came back positive for drugs. That's a full 6% lower than the general population. The program is going to cost the state of Florida some $175 million per year, according to Ron. And, you know, you're right, Ron, and we talked about this last week. The reality in my world is somebody, he's got to be profiting from this somewhere. There's got to be a brother-in-law who has a testing thing. He's got to be somebody in the process. And what bothers me is so many people in the general public say, yes, we should spend that $175 million to go after that 2% because it's worth it to keep those people under our thumb. And, you know, I got to be honest, if you're on welfare, if you're struggling that badly, I know I'm going to get some guff over this. I don't want to take away your vice to drown the sorrow. I mean, you know, I remember when I was a kid growing up in the projects, one of the winos on the street said, man, you know, I said, why are you drinking all the time? You know, kill the pain. You know, the reality is he's never going to get a job. He's never going to be able to move up. There's no bus line. There are no jobs in the area. He was injured. He's a broken, beat up old dude. And the only thing that kept him going was he got up every day and he got loaded. Is that right? Is that wrong? I don't know. Should I have to pay for it? I think I'd rather pay for that than have him put a gun in my face. Thoughts? All right, none.
I haven't given a lot of thought, Rick. I'd have to think about that one, to be honest.
Now, anyway, 2% in Florida is the email. Andy writes, and if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally and use them on the air occasionally. He writes, these states with 12 or 26 weeks of unemployment watered down, why would a working class person want to live there? There should be a mass exodus, get up and leave. With no consumers or population, these states will get the message. These governors instituting these reduced unemployment benefit policies should be afraid, scared to death of being in public without armed guards. Working people should be chasing these Scrooges all over the state, wherever they go to speak or are found in public. I've been calling for, you know, not the violent stuff, not the, you know, the armed guard stuff, but I've been calling for people to get out and you know, go to Washington, go to the capitals. I've been waiting for it, and well, I'm hoping at some point it does happen. But the reality is, as we talked about earlier, they have done such a great job of pushing people into the shadows, of keeping people away from each other, and not knowing who's unemployed and slicing and dicing, that I don't know that that organization is possible.
Well, I was gonna bring out the Tea Party, although the Tea Party was very well financed, but beyond that, there were individuals who just were bound and determined to get out there on the street and have their voice heard, and there were some. To be honest, I don't want to paint them with a broad brush that, you know, the big money people manipulated all of them, because there were some people that sincerely believed that we were spending too much. Although I don't agree with them with the solutions, but they were out there and they didn't give up and they were loud and yeah, they got ornery sometimes, and that's, you know, to a certain degree, I have to admit they were effective. And maybe that's what we mean.
Maybe so. Let me get right on that. Let me suck my teeth a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember going to one of the Tea Party rallies. And I'll never forget the guy who, you know, had his sign, smaller government, less spending. smaller government, less spending. Never forget him. He was there with several of his buddies. And I asked him, how at 1 o'clock in the afternoon can you be out at a protest with your sign that says smaller government, less spending? Turns out he was on unemployment. And he was on an extension of unemployment. And I told him that I could fix that problem that he wanted to solve very quickly. We could have less government and less spending. And we would take away his unemployment and the friends that he had there protesting the government spending that he was collecting. And you know what? He didn't like that. He didn't like that at all. Because it affected him. And again, this whole spending thing, yeah, let's cut somebody else's spending, not mine. It's kind of a sacred cow issue. And look, I don't believe we have a spending problem. I think we have an allocation problem. I think there are some priorities that we've set that I don't think are the right priorities. And I think there are some things that we've left unprioritized. I think education, I think healthcare, these are areas where we should be making sure that every person has quality in both sectors. I don't know that I'm thrilled with the idea of having a military as bloated as we have. I just not so thrilled.
Well, that individual that you talked to,
I love him.
That day, I would bet if you talked to him, he would probably say, well, one of the areas is, you know, those people that take advantage of welfare. And probably there might have even been a tad of racism in him. And also this belief that all we have to do is get people to work for nothing who represent us up in the hill, and somehow we'll have just oceans of money. Well, you know, I would be one. I wouldn't be adverse to saying, well, maybe we need to look at some of the spending programs which go to benefit those up on the hill. But really, compared to the spending in the area of defense, depending on where else we're going to look at, that's a very small portion. I mean, the answer to some of these people is basically the message that the right wingers are talking about, including the governor of Texas, and that is less government is better. They are anti-government. Well, is that really the solution? No, the answer is responsible government. The answer is to put the right people in government who represent the interest of everyone. And that's not easy to do. And that requires people to get involved.
There you go. So get out there and make your voices heard. In fact, on Labor Day, I would say, you know, turn off the gas grill. You know, maybe start and think about what Labor Day is all about. I give credit to a guy named Randy Ratke, president of the Marathon County Central Labor Council in Wausau, Wisconsin. They are saying, you know what? We're not going to let any Republicans to our Labor Day parade. And I got to be honest, I can't argue with that. Given in Wisconsin what's gone on in that state, generally I'm an all-inclusive guy. If you support labor, I want you standing next to me. But if you look at... You look at what's going on in Wisconsin. I don't know that there's anybody there on the Republican side of the aisle that supports labor, so they shouldn't be walking in the Labor Day parade. They shouldn't be participating in what is a day for working people. Labor Day is about celebrating some of the fights that have been won over the years. The fight to a weekend, there's a good idea. Some of the child labor laws, there's a good idea. You know, minimum wage, maximum hour laws, you know, vacations, for instance, health care, maternity leave, all of the things that, you know, that labor fought for. I think it's too easy for us, since we've always had it, to not really care how we got it. And this is one of those discussions I like to have with folks. You know, hey, you know, where'd that come from? And why are we willing to give it up? I mean, you stop and think of all the things that we've given up over the last 20 years. Oh, yeah, sure, take the overtime back. We want to have flex time. Yeah, that's what we want. Take away our health care. Sure, we want co-pays. We want higher deductibles. Yeah, take that defined benefit pension away. That was a pain. We want our 401k. But I like his idea. And I hope other folks follow along. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Our good friend Victoria Jones. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
How did you weather the storm?
Not bad. I did not lose power for the first time ever.
Wow. That's really saying something.
It means that Pepco, who I consider the world's worst power company, has, I hate to admit it, upped their game somewhat.
Or maybe just in your neighborhood, because you were bad-mouthing them on Friday.
Well, we did lose 800,000 people in Maryland, but Pepco was not responsible for all of them.
All right, well, that's good. And it's good that everyone made it through the storm, did pretty well, a little damage, but all right, I think.
Yeah, no, it was bad. It was very bad in Virginia, nearly a million people without power. I just think it varied from where you were.
And I'm just glad it's over. That's all.
Yes.
So now I can go to the store and there will be milk and bread on,
yes,
on the aisles. So let's get to the news. I guess the president has announced a new member to the Council of Economic Advisers, new chairman
for the Council of Economic Advisers, Alan Krueger, professor of economics at Princeton, also former chief economist and assistant secretary for economic policy at the Treasury Department from 2009 to 2010. He's considered a brilliant labor economist and an interesting guy, actually. And he, would, of course, replace Austin Goolsbee. He was nominated today in the Rose Garden. I was there. And the appointment comes at a critical time for the administration because Obama is going to deliver this big speech next week proposing new ideas for creating jobs, with the unemployment rate at 9.1%. By the way, this guy's written a great deal in academia. One of his studies was about how if you increase the minimum wage,
yep,
you do not slow down job growth.
In fact, his study was done here in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey, where New Jersey had raised the minimum wage. Their employment numbers actually went up. Pennsylvania stayed the same, and the employment numbers actually went down.
Well, there you go.
So, you know, I had followed him for some time. I think he's a great choice. He also, one of his other things, he was the guy who showed the effect on earnings with higher education. So he's the guy who's kind of pushing along the higher ed thing by showing just how much you're going to make over a lifetime. And so that's something else. And the cash for clunkers, another big thing.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting guy. Joseph Ferreira, who's CEO of a New York financial advisory firm, a man I know well and whose opinion I trust on this kind of thing,
also went to Princeton, served on Princeton's Center for Economic Policy Studies, and is a visiting professor there, said to me today that he's an excellent economist, mild-mannered, thoughtful, not combative, a great labor economist at a time when jobs are finally becoming the priority for the administration, intelligent, calm, rigorous, and not political.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I think he's a great guy. He's a great choice. I think he's going to have great advice. The question is, will Obama take it?
I don't know, and I don't know whether it's going to get as far as that because he has to get confirmed by the Senate. Even though he's been confirmed once, that was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the whole cash for clunkers thing, I see that jumping up and biting him, and especially the minimum wage thing. I see that another strike against him on the radical right.
Well, the RNC was sending around talking points about him within 5 minutes of the president announcing him. He'd done some other interesting studies, including one about, which I found really fascinating, actually, which I'm trying to find and I can't find, but about the value of rock concert tickets and whose concert's the most valuable. And he found that mixed-sex groups tend to command the lowest ticket prices, and female bands command the highest, and has a variety of theories for why ticket prices have risen dramatically since the 1980s. He wrote a paper in 2005 with Marie Connolly. Very interesting. Now, that is belied, of course, by Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, I'm starting to think of all the mixed bands, and I'm going, well, I'll have to read this.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you can find the big piece in the Washington Post on his academic things.
Yeah, I will most certainly have to look this up now. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yes.
It'll give me something to go after.
Thing he ever did.
I wouldn't go that far, but I'm hoping that the confirmation goes well, because I look at this guy and I think this maybe who we need at a time when we need it. Maybe somebody who's got some good ideas.
Could be.
Also, the other question, going back to Irene, I've seen some statements come out, like we talked on Friday. Cantor's come out and said, well, no, we need to start cutting. I've seen some reports of the costs. Where are we going to get the money?
Well, it's a very good question, and one to which I'm not sure anybody really knows the answer, because the money's not exactly there. Cantor is saying, of course, his staff said on Thursday, we aren't going to speculate on damage before it happens, period. But as you know, Eric has consistently said that additional funds for federal disaster relief ought to be offset with spending cuts.
As did Ron Paul. I mean, you know, the radical right is pretty much on board with this.
Yeah, and that's what he's saying. Now, they're talking about $7 billion, but that is expected to rise.
Absolutely. I mean, when you get into it, that, you know, the $7 billion's a guess. I saw a guy, Peter Morici from the University of Maryland, said the whole storm could cost the country somewhere around $45 billion when you add in lost economic activity.
It's quite extraordinary. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary.
And it all comes down to jobs, and I guess the Republicans have a new jobs plan. Can I guess? Can I guess what it might be?
Go on.
Build new roads and bridges?
No.
Invest in education?
No.
Broadband, broadband technology across the country to help rural areas access the internet?
No.
No?
No, mostly it involves killing environmental and labor regulations and pushing tax cuts for businesses.
Well, that's not new. That's what they've been preaching for 30 years.
Yes,
that's what got us into this mess.
They plan a lot of it. They plan basically to do something every week.
Like
almost every week, they're going after something. Eric Cantor sent out a memo today, and he's listed 10 regulations he contend to be the most harmful. Some of these regulations don't exist yet, nevertheless. Most of them are issued by the EPA, but they're also going on the National Labor Relations Board and the health care law, and also going for tax relief. But the first thing they're going after is the bill to bar the National Labor Relations Board from ordering businesses to close or relocate jobs under any circumstances.
Yeah, heaven forbid they have to follow the law like the rest of us. The whole Boeing thing comes down to one very simple concept. They are breaking the law. And if they're able to break the law, I should be able to break the law whenever I want. I mean, at the end of it, that's what it is.
They may get somewhere with this one.
That's because I think people got rocks in their heads. This is a rule of law question. And at the end of it, I guess it has to come down to, do you have the right to strike without repercussion or do you not? Because that's what this is all about. This is all about, you know, years ago, those guys in Washington went on strike and the company said, well, we're going to get you. And now they're doing that.
They're also going after a number of EPA regulations, some that haven't been finalized or even proposed.
Nice. Well, nothing like being a little proactive in your destruction of our environment.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. I wish they would take that kind of thinking and putting it into, solving the country's problems in a positive direction instead of making me go back to breathing dirty air and drinking brown water.
They do plan to do some of that because they plan in October or November to vote on a bill that would bar the EPA from regulating coal ash as hazardous waste.
Nice.
And then later in the winter, they're going to tackle a bill that will block the EPA from regulating farm dust and repeal the EPA's pending reconsideration of the George W. Bush administration's 2008 ozone standard.
Beautiful, beautiful. And my children complain now about having to slather up with sunscreen. I can't wait till they're teenagers. Oh, it's just nuts. And finally, I guess Dick Cheney has a new book out that, heads are supposed to be exploding.
Heads are supposed to be exploding all over Washington. The thing to read, really, is the New York Times review by Michiko Kakutani, written on August the 25th, with the headline, Leaving Regrets to Others, Cheney Speaks, because it's very, very brilliant and very, very funny.
I'll have to take a look at that. I mean, I saw one interview that Cheney took the battery out of his pacemaker or whatever it is, and I was like, there you go, you got a chance.
No, this is brilliant, because this goes through the book piece by piece by piece by piece, and it really does go through the book, but it is an absolutely, I wouldn't say it was a venomous look at the book, but it takes him to account for every place where he basically leaves something out. It talks about how he circumvents important questions. He doesn't explain things that he doesn't explain. It's really I think it's the best piece that I've read on the book.
Yeah, I'm sure it, and I won't read it, I'll tell you that right now, because I really, everything to me will be just contrived, or like you said, it will be something that was omitted on purpose, but I'm kind of interested in the response that like Powell gave the other day, that he said it was a cheat, a bunch of cheap
shots. Powell was very outspoken yesterday. He said that many of the disclosures seem to be, quote, cheap shots that he's taking at me and other members of the administration who serve to the best of our ability for President Bush.
Yeah, and he went after Condi, the whole tearful thing. And again,
yeah.
I took that as being his generation, kind of a sexist remark.
And that's exactly what Valerie Plame said within the last 20 minutes in an interview. She said the same thing.
Interesting stuff. And again, I'm not going to read the book, and I don't suggest anybody else bother. Just read that funny report that you said. I'm going to take a look for that.
It's really, really very, very interesting. Leaving Regrets to Others, Cheney Speaks. That's the headline. That's the title of the piece.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. And now what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Trick, there's a UPI story coming out of Pittsburgh about Jean Orie and her sister, and this has been an ongoing saga now for months and months. Back in 2012, they were charged with conspiring to use Senator Orie's paid legislative staff to do political campaign work. The trial came up in March, and it ended in a mistrial. The judge agreed with the prosecution's accusations that there was some tampering of some key piece of evidence that Orie's lawyers had used to discredit the chief witness, who was at one time Orie's chief aide. They brought in experts from the U.S. Secret Service and other experts from the federal government to check out these documents, and they since have charged, believe it or not, Ray, They have since charged Senator Orey with perjury, forgery, and tampering with evidence. Now, she's convicted of these charges and the other charges of that she came up on with using public money in political campaigns. She could be facing a large number of years in prison, so stay tuned on that one. But it's apparent that the Orey sisters have some more problems. Story coming out of the Democratic Ways and Means Committee in Washington. Earlier this year, Senator Sandra Levin, who is a ranking member of the House Ways and Means Committee, and Representative Ryan introduced H.R. 639, which was the Currency Reform and Fair Trade Act, to curtail continued Chinese currency manipulation. China's undervaluation of the currency artificially raises the price of U.S. exports to China and suppresses the price of Chinese imports into the United States. To give you some numbers and how that has affected the U.S. economy, according to latest estimates, because the Chinese have been successful in doing that, they have eliminated between 500,000 and 1.5 million American jobs. Estimates are that the Chinese have undervalued their currency up to about 28.5%. The number of members who have supported the bill in September was set at 348. It's been 6 months since the introduction of the bill without action by Republican members. 54 members of the Republicans caucus have co-sponsored this bill this year, and 189, which is the number of co-sponsors on H.R. 639, which is definitely needed. The Chinese have been undervaluing their currency and just hurting us with the economy. And as the estimates have been made in this report, up to 1.5 million jobs have been lost because of it. Interesting scenario coming occurring with this gaming control board. It's a story coming out of the Patriot News in Harrisburg. A gentleman by the name of Greg Fott had been the chairman of the gaming control board. He was removed as chairman by the governor because of a grand jury investigation that came out and basically said that there were some members of the board who were too close to the insiders in the gaming industry. The governor removed him, and now, because of the law, which the law says that the gaming commission would be made up of 7 people, the governor appoints 3, including the chairman, and the leadership of both the Senate and the House, Democrat and Republican, can each appoint 1. And the Democrats have decided to appoint Mr. Fott back on the committee, even though some Republicans on that committee thought he did a good job. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. It'll be interesting to see how the governor reacts, and if they do a good job. Back to you, Rick.
All righty, let's take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up.
Me and my people are through. Me and my people are ready. Me and my people are just about to.
Right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. A lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible. The best way to win an election is deliberate deception.
Same thing happened in 2000. You gotta love fudge the numbers.
I love that. Got to tell you what the facts are. Facts are we fudge the numbers.
You know, you look a little bit like Gene Gene the Dancing Machine over there.
Yeah, well, now you are dating yourself.
Yes, I am.
During the break, I got an email. And I guess I said, just kind of out of the possibility that Rick Scott may have a relative involved in the drug testing thing. Someone sent me an email saying, hey, dummy, it's not only a relative, it's his wife. And I deserve that, hey, dummy, because this is something that I should have known. Evidently, the Soul Atlantic company that Rick Scott co-founded, evidently when he divested, he put all of the controlling shares into his wife's name. So it's kind of interesting that the big $178 million contract goes to his former company. Very, very cozy. And you wonder why he has a lower approval rating than Linda Thompson has. You got to wonder about that. No reaction from you? No chuckle? Nothing?
Well, he isn't very well liked. I guess my question is why they vote for the clown in the first place.
Because he wasn't the other guy? I don't know. Because they're nuts?
If I remember, and let's back up a little bit. If I remember, the Democrats kind of hurt themselves in that race.
Oh, you think?
They had a, what? There was a Democrat, but there was also a Democrat that ran as an independent, I believe. Or was it? No,
that
Republican.
Was the, that was the senatorial race.
Was that the senatorial race? Okay,
you had
you're
Meeks,
right. You're right. Yes,
you had
Meeks.
Rubio and
Meeks was
Chris,
the black representative.
The former,
yeah, okay.
The former governor.
You're correct. Okay. Yeah, I stand corrected.
Yeah, it was just a bad year in Florida. A little labor history today for those of you who are fans of the strip club. You know, the dancers at the San Francisco Lusty Lady Club voted 57 to 15 to be represented by SEIU Local 790. They ratified their first contract 8 months later, guaranteeing work shifts, protection against arbitrary discipline and termination, automatic hourly wage increases, sick days, a grievance procedure, and removal of one-way mirrors from the peep show booths. So, yeah, they want to be able to see the creeps that are in there looking at them. So there you go. And what's going on? Yeah, I don't know why you'd want to see that, but good for them. Also on this day in 1998, Northwest Pilots, after years of concessions to help the airline, started a two-week strike for higher pay, and they got a little bit. So good for them. In 2000, on this day, the delegates to the Minnesota AFL-CIO convention approved the launching of WorkdayMinnesota.org, something that is working to this day. Good for them. I know some of the folks that run that. And also today in the year 2007, the folks over at the Institute for Policy Studies and United for a Fair Economy reported that the CEOs of America's largest companies made an average of $10.8 million in 2006, or more than 364 times that of the average worker. Congratulations, thanks to the recession and then the subsequent bounce in CEO pay. CEO pay has gone up a little bit, and that number of 364 has jumped even higher. So good. We're going in the right direction. The wealthy are getting wealthier, and the rest of you working stiffs, well, you're struggling. And the way it should be. Take us back to the good old days. So that we end up having crimes like this. And I was looking through the website of the Patriot News, and I came across three stories, boom, 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 right next to each other, talking about Carlisle, where I live. And I'm going, the mean streets of C-Town, look out. Because here's the crime spree. One report was Sunday afternoon, a 65-year-old guy walked into the Giant store there and decided that he was going to stick a rack of ribs in his drawers and walk out. What's funny about this is he was drunk while doing it. This is not the first time. Back in May, did the exact same thing. I don't know what the fantasy is when he gets drunk to go shove ribs down his drawers. I don't know, but that's what he was doing. Also, another story right next to it in Carlisle. Somebody at the Dunkin' Donuts stole a whole bunch of money and keys and some other stuff. And I'm going, really? Mean streets? And then another woman decided she was going to stalk somebody and assault some folks. Kind of insanity. So the mean streets of C-Town. Just nuts. Just absolutely nuts.
You know, that guy that is trying to get away with stealing some ribs, do you think he could become a little better at it instead of doing it right in front of those working at the counter? Do you think?
Maybe that was part of the fantasy. I don't know. I'm thinking this is some kind of bizarre fantasy. You don't get caught doing the same thing twice in the same store without having something to lose. Here's a funny story for my religious friends who just love changing the teachings of Christ. Well, there's this guy, Stephen Sawyer, 58, in Kentucky, who decided, you know what? Since we're changing the words, we might as well change what Jesus looks like. And now Jesus looks like a muscular surfer. He looks like, you know, in some of the pictures, looks like a big hulking mass. Kind of like Fabio. So now Jesus looks like Fabio. Kind of a diversion from where I think he would look like, which is kind of like Yasser Arafat. But, you know, don't tell the radical right that, because they would lose their minds. But here again, you know, Jesus is now buff. He's been hitting the weights. He wouldn't take no guff from those poor people. He'd give them a good smack and tell them what's what. Come on, that's funny.
You
give me that goofy look.
Well, you know,
they got to buff up Jesus a little bit.
Well, Jesus actually, by all accounts, was fairly dark skinned.
Which is what I
know. I'm agreeing with you.
I'm sorry I asked.
I'm agreeing with you.
I'm sorry I asked. If you missed any portion of the program, go to thericksmithshow.com. You can download our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, just download the Stitcher app and take the program with you on the go. I want to thank all of our guests for being on the program this evening. Donna Cooper, Mitch Troutman, Kate Gordon, and, of course, Michael Evangelist, who talked to us about some great stuff. Again, podcast. Remember the podcast. Stitcher. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Have a great night. And remember, thericksmithshow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tireless flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and
Palled around with, you know, that's one of those Godzilla from Lostilla phrases. And if you read the story there, all you find out is that Saul became greatly wroth with David, and it doesn't say why. And David and Jonathan were like